Welcome to DC Special Cast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Paul Ken. This podcast is an exploration of DC's special comics of the Bronze Age, which included such titles as the aptly named DC Special and Special Series, but also DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, Four Star Superhero Spectacular, and others. If you've read any of these comics, you know they varied wildly in content, quality, and even format. They featured every possible genre of the comics industry at that time. So it's June, and DC has kicked off the Summer of Supergirl to coincide with the release of the Supergirl movie later this month. Of course, we're jumping right on that bandwagon. And to do that, today I am joined by a repeat guest, a great supporter of the Fire and Water Network, but most importantly, the biggest Supergirl expert we know. That's right, please welcome the super blogger of the Supergirl Comic Box Commentary, Dr. Ange. Hey, Ange, welcome back to DC Special Cast.
I can't thank you enough for inviting me back. There is a lot to talk about in terms of the issue that we've got, and it's just incredible for me to hear something as crazy as it is the Summer of Supergirl. You know, I started the blog because I felt like she was a forgotten character, and here we are just swimming in appearances for her. And I will say, in particular, this issue has some nods to current comic continuity, which we'll touch on, which I think is great.
Yeah, that's terrific. And, you know, the movie's coming out. The people that in our listening age and group, this is not necessarily the Supergirl we grew up with. But I'm excited for the movie. I'm really looking forward to going and seeing it. And I assume you are too.
Yeah, it's based on Tom King's Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow miniseries, which I have some trouble with. I think he Tom Kinged her the way that he has Tom Kinged other characters. You never like it when your name is a verb. But my sense is that James Gunn knows that you can't be that dark. And I just get a sense from what little we've seen in terms of commercials and trailers that in the end, this is going to be almost like a redemption arc for her, that in the end, she will like be, okay, I've dealt with this trauma and I'm moving on.
Right. I get the same vibe. You know, it was funny. I hadn't read The Woman of Tomorrow. I couldn't get past the first issue. I tried a couple times digitally. And then last fall with the DC Universe subscription, they send you a trade paperback every fall, or this when they send mine. And that's the one I got this year. So I finally sat down earlier this year and read it. And I enjoyed it more than I thought. I think there is an arc there for her that's heroic. We'll see what they do. I don't know what they're doing with Lobo, but we'll see.
Well, you know, the backstory is he originally wanted it to be Lobo and Supergirl and like the Ruthie character. Right. And DC said no. And so he's like, okay, how about Supergirl as a Lobo character? Which just sounds like he wrote a story and then plugged a character into the hole that needed to get fit. I think what's going to end up happening is that she is going to look at Lobo and say, if I continue down the road that I am on, I'm going to become Lobo.
Yeah.
And I don't want to become Lobo. And so he will be like a dark mirror for which she sort of veers away. That's my gut.
I was thinking something along those lines, but we'll see. All right, but well, before we get too much farther, let's take a moment to thank our sponsors. This episode of DC Special Cast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 40% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. So, Ange, what recommendations do you have as we kick off that Summer of Supergirl?
I'm going to pick the Supergirl Bizarro Girl trade paperback 2026 edition. Writer Sterling Gates and artists mostly Jamal Igle and Bernard Chang, if I can remember. The tagline is, can Supergirl and Bizarro Girl reach Bizarro World in time to combat the dreaded godship? And when a Bizarro version of Supergirl appears in Metropolis, Supergirl herself punches first and asks a question later. But when she learns Bizarro Girl is a refugee on the run from a disaster that threatens to destroy her world, she realizes she has more in common than she thought. Originally, this was $19.99, but with InStock Trades, you save 40%. So it's now $11.99. And I'll just say I'm a huge fan of the Sterling Gates Jamal Igle run of that book. This is a great trade. If you like Woman of Tomorrow, and if you think that that's sort of the flavor, this is actually a good arc to sort of explore another writer dealing or discussing the trauma that Kara has gone through. This is right out of New Krypton. She has been reunited with both of her parents, who are both killed in that arc, and she's sort of starting to recede a little bit. So people who say this character is eternally sunny and has never dealt with her trauma have just not read all of her stories, and this is a great one. In fact, I would say, from that point of view, this is better than Woman of Tomorrow.
My pick is DC Finest Supergirl, The Girl of Steel. DC Finest are great. I've got a bunch of them. They're great on the shelf. They're great to read. I've just enjoyed them quite a bit. And this is obviously the beginning of Supergirl's adventures. It's got a lot in there, not quite to the stories we're going to read today, but just before, from Action 252, Adventure 278, Superman 139, and a bunch of Lois Lane's and Jimmy Olsen's. So it's a great compilation. You know, originally $39.99. The in-stock trades price $23.19. You save 42%. I mean, for 624 pages, $23, it's a deal. What else can I say? All right, so now we're going to talk about, of course, starring Supergirl, Super DC Giant S-24. That was cover dated May-June of 1971, on sale March 4th of 1971, with a cover price of 25 cents, had 64 pages, edited by E. Nelson Bridwell. So what's cool about this book is that it's like a mini trade paperback. It contains reprints of the Supergirl stories from four consecutive issues of Action Comics, and all by the same creative team, written by Leo Dorfman and art by Jim Mooney. Action 295, 296, 297, and 298 from 1962 into 1963. And it's been reprinted many times. Supergirl, The Silver Age, Volume 2, trade paperback. Supergirl, The Silver Age Omnibus, Volume 1. A Showcase Presents Supergirl, Volume 2. And the first one, The Supergirl, Silver Age, Volume 2, is on DC Universe Unlimited. So you can read all these stories if you want to follow along. And you have a physical copy, correct?
That is correct.
Excellent. So do I. And online, this is a book that runs anywhere from $5 to $25, depending on condition. The $5 one I saw was pretty beat up, so I would expect to pay $10 to $20 if you want a decent copy. But I was at a recent show and I saw a dealer trying to get $50 for one up on the wall. And I was like, I think some people might be increasing the price in short term for the movie, but I would guess the prices would come down again later. As far as the original Action Comics go, you should be able to get a decent copy of any of the four of them between $25 and $50 a piece. But they're very plentiful, right? So Superman was selling a lot of copies in the early 60s. People did tend to keep them, unlike some of the romance or Western books, which are harder to find.
Yeah, I'll say that I think I was lucky enough to find mine at a convention back in the day. So I think it's in really good condition. And I think paid somewhere between $5 and $10.
Yeah, mine too. Mine's in good condition. And I can't imagine I paid any more than $10 for it.
Yeah, and one of the things that, like I said before, I love the comment that you said that this is like a mini trade, because when you read those old Action Comics, the Superman stories are often one and done, like faced with something, done. But Supergirl, especially around this time, they were doing like long form stuff. And so when you think about like Action 285 is like a big deal, she's revealed to the world. Remember, she was a secret emergency weapon. Right. There's like a 6-issue storyline around that where she like first meets Les Lalar and then gets captured and then like comes out, but then loses her powers, but then gains her powers and then gets revealed to the world. There's almost more continuity in the Supergirl stories of this time period than there are in the Superman stories, which really kind of have I'm fighting an ape. Now I have an ant head. Now it's Supergirl again, right? And then, as I said, I just think it's really fantastic as a longtime fan to see Sophie Campbell, who is both the writer and artist of the current book, really embracing all of this stuff. So Les Lalar is a big character in this story. Les Lalar is a big character in that story. This cover of this magazine was homaged in the second cover of the current series. And Lena Luthor, in this book, Lena Thorle, is a character in the current book. And there's just millions of stuff that is being dropped into the current title. So if you like the current Supergirl book, then you should definitely seek this, because this will have a lot of ripples to what's happening there.
You pointed out that cover homage to me, which I think is cool. So I will include a picture of that in the gallery. Let's talk about the timeline. This book came out in March 1971. There were definitely some really cool books from DC, including Action Comics number 400. That's the one that Neil Adams drew, a cover of Superman coming into a room where has his supposed, quote, son, half man and half beast. We also got Mr. Miracle number 2, so we're right near the beginning of Kirby's Fourth World. There's also a DC Special number 12 starring the Viking Prince, which I would love to do on this show at some point if I can get a volunteer. But the thing that struck me, Edge, was that when looking at Mike's Amazing World this month, this was peak time for Neil Adams covers at DC. This month there are 9 Adams covers: Action, Batman, Detective, Flash, House of Mystery, Justice League, Phantom Stranger, Superman, and World's Finest. 9 out of 27. That's a third of DC's line, which I thought was cool.
Yeah, you know a Neil Adams cover when you see it. He really was sort of like house style back then. I think so many people were trying to be Neil Adams, and all of those covers are great. I think that, you see them, you recognize that cover.
Absolutely. Over at Marvel, we got Amazing Spider-Man number 97. That's one of the drug issues that didn't have Comics Code approval. But frankly, a relatively weak lineup, it's in my opinion, for Marvel. Other than that, I think they were maybe still reeling a little bit from Kirby's departure. I don't know. But Ange, what about you? What were your favorites from this month?
Yeah, I took a look and I'll say this was in the middle of Supergirl being the headliner in Adventure Comics. And Adventure Comics number 406 came out this month. It's almost surprinty for people that love that word, yeah. Where she's walking. Yeah. She's like right in the middle and half of her is Supergirl and half of her is Linda Danvers. And then in the background is Nasty Luthor, Luthor's niece. There is Superman number 237, which is part of my beloved Kryptonite Nevermore storyline where he's facing off against a bunch of ogre-y looking things. But the funniest one has to be Flash 206, which is Iris taking a header after jumping out of a plane on the ground. She's like, I told you I was invulnerable. See? And just chin first to the ground. I definitely would have bought that off the rack if I had seen it. I was 1 year old. So...
Thanks always to our favorite website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. All right, on to our comics. So, Ange, would you like to talk about this cover?
Yeah, it's got the 70s logo of Supergirl right at the top, which I think is Martin Gray's favorite logo. We'll have to ask him. He's very logo-centric.
Yes, he is. I'm sure he'll tell us. He's not shy either.
And then it's almost like a triptych. It's like split into three columns of equal length. And the first one says, why can't Supergirl stop Super Luthor? And it's Luthor in really a Superman-looking outfit, albeit purple and green, putting his fist through a Superman statue. In the middle is, who is this Supergirl imposter? And it's like one girl saying, I'm Supergirl, and another Supergirl saying, no, I am. And then the last one is, how are these Phantom Zone villains freed? And there is a suspicious-looking blonde woman messing with a device, letting out Jack Sur and General Zod. This is truth in advertising. All three of these scenes appear in the story. And if you were like, this is one story, how are they going to... These are seemed like three very disparate plot points, but they're all in this great story. And then at the bottom, clearly lifted from the Adventure Comics run, is a Mike Sekowski Supergirl face with her saying, extra, new Supergirl costumes designed by you, the reader. So if the story wasn't enough, maybe that would intrigue you. Certainly think there's a lot to mull over here, and it certainly made me interested. I think it's a good cover.
You know, it's interesting that it's Kurt Swan that does the main image. Mike says that the inker is Sheldon Moldoff, which I was surprised to, you know, I thought that was interesting. And then, yeah, obviously, that's Mike Sekowski, Supergirl at the bottom. But I love how the Phantom Zone projector looks like a vanity.
Yeah.
The villains can jump out. And you got the old style General Zod where he's got like the police uniform on, which I always think is fun. You know, I was most intrigued by the one in the middle, like two Supergirls. What's happening with that? So I love it. So we get a table of contents, which frankly is a little boring. A lot of times, you know, we get new art and so forth on the table of contents. We don't really get that. We get Super DC Giant Supergirl. I don't know that we need to run through the whole table of contents, Ange, if you have any thoughts on it.
Just that I like in the top corner is a picture of Supergirl in one of her like 70s variant outfits. Usually we're used to seeing at this time period, the red shorts, the hot pants and the halter top. And this is not that. This is like a full blue skirt with like a nice disco belt and high boots, which he definitely wears in a couple of the Adventure Comics of this time.
I always like to imagine Nelson Bridwell with an X-Acto knife in the production room, or that's probably a little too early for Bob Rozakis. So, you know, I just think that's kind of fun to imagine. Anyway, I will, of course, post the cover and the table of contents and the recent Supergirl homage cover and plenty of other pages from this comic on the gallery page for DC Special Cast at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Let's jump into our first story. It's entitled The Girl with the X-Ray Mind, a 13-pager. So this is the day where backup stories were 13 pages, which is amazing. Yeah. Fair disclosure, I got a good start on the story summaries from Mike's Amazing World. Ange, would you like to summarize the first story for our listeners?
For sure. Linda Lee attends a presentation about ESP at Midvale High. She meets a new girl in town, Lena Farrell, who scores the lowest on the ESP test. But when Linda checks with her supervision, she finds that Lena had actually made a perfect score. And the presenter, a Dr. Anton, not me, changed all of the answers and said that she got them all wrong. Linda assumes that he just made an error, but we will see that Dr. Anton had a more nefarious reason. Lena and Linda become fast friends, and we find out that Lena has applied to the FBI for a job as a secretary, but she's rejected for the job. So Linda decides to find out why, as Supergirl. She flies to the FBI and learns that Lena has no record of her past at all. No birth certificate, nothing. The Girl of Steel decides that the best thing for her to do is fly back in time to find out what happened and learns that Lena is actually Lex Luthor's little sister. Get it? Thoral Luthor? Her name was changed long ago to protect the family from Lex's shame. Shortly thereafter, their parents died in a car accident, so she has no knowledge of her background. Supergirl also learns, welcome to the Silver Age, that Lena gained her ESP ability from a space brain that Lex was experimenting on. Supergirl decides to keep Lena's heritage a secret, but is sad that her friend cannot get the job she wanted. Meanwhile, Lena is approached by Dr. Anton as a representative of the Bank Busters, a criminal organization, to help them with their crimes. She's got ESP. She agrees, and she's bitter that she was rejected by the FBI, and oh my gosh, is she following in her brother's footsteps? When Lex learns, through the criminal grapevine, that his sister has joined the Bank Busters, he contacts Supergirl because he wants to protect his sister. But during her first crime, Lena triggers knockout gas and captures the criminal. She only joined the gang to trap them and impress the FBI. The end.
Very good. So, Ange, what did you think of this first one?
I think it's great. I think there's so much of it that I love. One, you know, you have to remember that this is back in the day, there was no internet, right? So when she goes back in time and you learn about Lex's history, this is probably where somebody first learned, oh, he's ticked off because he went bald, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because of Superboy. So that stuff I think is great. I think everything has to be a little bit connected. So the fact that Lena Thoral just happens to live in little small town of Midvale of all of the places in America is wonderful. And Supergirl, I think, is in this time, she's just very charming. She just wants to do what's right. She just wants to help people. She's got this funny little quirk where she puts like a finger to her face whenever she's thinking really hard. And perhaps crazy enough, the fact that Lex is, look, I'm a criminal, but I don't want my sister to be a criminal, right? A nice little turn, right? You know, you don't expect that. He goes through a whole arc himself in this mini trade, as you said. But I just thought the whole thing was charming.
I thought this was delightful. Let's talk about the art for a minute. Again, by the same team throughout, Jim Mooney, and there's no inker, so I assume he inked it himself. Supergirl is young. She looks cute. She's very age appropriate. She has all those mannerisms, like you talk about, like touching her finger to her chin. It's very consistent. But what I was really interested, again, because I've read this like four times in the past 2 weeks, right? Lena looks older and more sophisticated than Kara or Linda and Supergirl the whole time. Slightly different hairstyle and all the rest. And I found that very interesting. I'm like, wait a minute, she's in high school too? Maybe she's a senior and Linda's a freshman or something. I don't know. I started to start thinking about all those things and my brain started to hurt. So I decided not to. But I don't know if I'm on track there or what your thoughts are with regard to that art style.
Yeah, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but this version of Supergirl, there is a graduates high school, goes to Stanhope University later in this action run. So there probably is some, you know, few years difference. I think the thing that gets me is in that prior story that I talked about, Les LaLaur looks so much like Supergirl that they are able to replace each other.
Right.
And we'll see coming up, she also looks close enough like somebody else that she's able to replace, right? So that's a little bit funny. But I just love it, as you say, especially when she's part of the Bank Busters, she's in a little domino mask.
Oh, I know.
She's in like a shoulderless red, almost evening gown. She looks like she stepped right out of the spirit.
She reminded me of the blonde Phantom, the Marvel character.
Yes, no, exactly. I said she looks like she should be in a spirit comic drawn by Will Eisner. I thought that was just charming.
And I love that Supergirl decides, well, the thing to do when the FBI turns her down, I'm just going to go back in time and find out what happens. I love the casual time travel of these era of Superman and Supergirl and more Weisinger stories. It's like crossing the streets. I'll go back, but she goes back two different times or two different eras. First she sees the wreck, but then she goes back farther to see and discover, you know, how she got her ESP powers when Lex was experimenting with the alien brain.
Whole thing was great.
A couple other points. Here's Lex. He's experimenting with the brain and I'm looking at page 6 of the story where Lena touches the brain's thing and she goes zap and her hair stands up on end. It looks like the little girl's got electrocuted. And, you know, Lex is nice here. He comforts her. He says, but wait a minute, you just destroyed that space brain.
Yeah. And he's like, but don't worry. I got something to make you feel better. I got you a Superboy doll, right? You
I
know,
love it. I love it.
Lena has followed Supergirl around. You may remember her. She was a big part of the CW television show.
Yep.
And there is a really well-regarded all-ages book called Supergirl and Her Cosmic Adventures in the Eighth Grade.
Yes.
That Lena is in. And at the end of it, there is a line about how space brains are coming or something like that. It's a fun little quirk about that character, too.
My next favorite part is Lex getting the news from his invented radio. And instead of listening to the news or the sports, he listens to the crime channel on a private radio program.
Yeah. And it's great because they say something like, well, the last time he had a radio, we used it to escape. We can't let him have a radio anymore. And then he's like, I found a piece of crystal quartz in the prison yard that I was able to use to create a shortwave radio.
Smallville people weren't very nice back in this time. They basically ran the Luthors out of town. And then the mother and father were killed. So it's just a terrible situation. So then we get to the point where she's in the bank and Supergirl's watching to see if she really is bad. But of course, Lena sets off the trap and the gas takes down the bad guys, which was a great way to end the story, I thought.
Yeah, I thought spot on.
Cute little ending where she says, you know, every time I see a telepathic picture of my friend Linda Lee Danvers when I'm talking to you, Supergirl, I wonder why that is.
Yeah.
No, I just thought it was great. Very clever. The ending's cute. Just a good story. And, you know, you don't know this is the first part of a 4-issue epic, you know? So we'll have to get right on. Any final thoughts on this one before we move on to number two?
No, just that Lena, again, has survived. She's now Lex's daughter, right? Not sister in current continuity.
Right. Story number two, again, by the same creative team. This one's called The Girl Who Was Supergirl's Double, a 12-pager. I'll read this one. So Linda Lee and Dick Malvern attend a costume party. Their friend Lena Thorall shows up dressed as Supergirl. After an attempted robbery, Dick begins to believe Lena is Supergirl. He ditches Linda and is now interested in Lena. After a series of coincidences, Dick believes his theory is confirmed. Meanwhile, Lex contacts Supergirl to ask her to help him give Lena a birthday gift of some diamonds. Supergirl is happy to help, but then when Dick thinks Lena created the diamond by crushing coal, she finally admits to him that, yes, she is indeed Supergirl. Needless to say, Supergirl is not thrilled by that. To be continued. So this is just a cute one. What'd you think of this one?
The number of coincidences that have to happen to play out this plot is like almost crazy,
yeah.
But welcome to the Silver Age. I will say again, I'll try to keep these things short, but the person throwing the party who's dressed up as Cleopatra, who's Clarissa Gilted, was name dropped in Supergirl number one by Sophie Campbell.
Wow.
So like, this is like a deep.
She's like the Veronica. You know,
yes.
She's Veronica. She's got the rich father. I was going to ask you if she's in more of these stories because she acts like a Veronica would. She dresses up in the most expensive costume, wears her father's very expensive jewels, has four guys carrying her in as Cleopatra on a...
Yeah.
Really funny. I thought she was funny.
In comparison, you know, Linda's like, oh, I don't want to be too flashy. I don't want people to notice me. So I'll go as Pocahontas, right? You know, which I think is funny.
Yeah, it's cute. And Dick is, of course, dressed as Superboy, Superman, I guess. But we find out that the butler was bad in the rich guy's house, let some bad guys know that they're going to come steal the jewels off the rich girl. But the rich girl is really mad because she doesn't win the costume contest. They give it to Dick, Malvern, and Lena dressed as Superman and Supergirl, which I think is a riot because her costume's way better.
For sure. And some of it's quite funny. Like, you know, this is a teenage costume party. There's a newspaper reporter there with a camera who's like, let's hook up some wires and pretend that you guys are flying so we can take a picture of you two.
This, I thought, was actually a quite clever scene. They have their trophies. The two bad guys dressed as astronauts come in to the party and they throw this knockout gas. And Linda has to pretend she's knocked out, right? And they steal the necklace off the rich girl. But then she quick changes to Supergirl and conks them out and then puts her costume back on. But then Lena happens to be the first one to recover from the gas, other than Linda, of course, and ties up the bad guys. Then Dick and the police mistake her for Supergirl, which I think is a riot.
Yeah, they're like, it's a good thing that you were here, Supergirl. And she's like, who, me? But it's funny. And I'll point out on page 20, the middle panel, mm-hmm. You'll see them throw the knockout pellets, and you'll actually see something bounce into the trophy that's on the ground, which is a plot point later on. So, like, you got to keep your eyes open.
I see it now. I did not notice that. Great catch. Great catch. I will definitely include that page.
Yeah.
So Dick now says, I think she's lying, Linda. I used to think you were Supergirl, but now I know it's her. And then he brought Linda to the dance and he just ditches her and starts dancing with Lena the whole time, drops Linda off early so he can drive in his car some more with Lena.
Yeah.
Now she seems more of her age. Was Dick Malvern older then?
No, I think they always had them be the same age. And he was an orphan in the same orphanage as her. He
Yeah.
was Dick Wilson at that point until he got adopted by the Malvern.
And then there's another one of these coincidences where that very gas pellet fell out of that trophy that Lena happens to knock over. But it's at the same time, there's a kryptonite box that he's supposed to dispose of. And he thinks that the kryptonite is what weakened Lena, which reinforces his theory, which I just thought was hysterical.
Yeah, the only reason why I know about that panel where it bounced in the cup, because I was, how did a knockout pellet from that robbery end up in Dick Malvern's house? I'm a little bit lost because that's not where the party was. And then you realize, oh, that's how it got there. And you know, they
Yeah.
say, unknown to Lena, one of the knockout gas pellets accidentally fell into the loving cup during the attempted robbery.
Yeah. I just took them at their word. I didn't go back and check, which I'm very impressed that you did. So that's really cool.
Yeah, and of course it is one of those things where it's, oh, I thought you were Supergirl. Now I find you knocked out next to a kryptonite rock. Okay, this cinches it. You must be Supergirl.
So Dick asks Lena to get rid of the kryptonite, which I thought was a little weird. But then she walks off. It's inside of a lead box, of course. And then she changes. She's looking quite Mad Men in her capri slacks, doing the digging in the yard somewhere. And Linda is helping her. And she's like, oh, do you want to see the kryptonite? And Linda's like, no, thanks.
Yeah.
I like that bit.
Too fun.
So then the plane's about to crash. Three of them are driving in Dick's car, and Linda uses her super breath to save the pilot. And Dick immediately assumes it's Lena who did it and gives her a great big kiss right in front of Linda, who then has a very upset expression on her face.
Yeah, the whole thing is Dick is basically being a dick. I'm just gonna say, right? You know, so like he's like, oh, I'm gonna invite Lena to come with me to this thing. You can sit in the back seat and watch me cuddle with her. It's like, what a jerk. Like, what are you doing?
Know.
Again, and then as they're driving, of course, this plane is crashing. A guy jumps out, but he can't open up his chute. But luckily, Linda is able to save him, and he assumes that it's Lena.
Then the last and most funny coincidence, we get a recap of Luthor being her big brother. He says, I created some diamonds before I turned criminal, so they're legally mine. There's the comics code making sure to come into this here, right? And I buried them. And I want you to take a couple of them and give them to Lena, and you can give the rest to charity if you'll do this favor for me, Supergirl. Which this is again another instance of Luthor being sweet to
Yeah.
send his sister a present. So Supergirl says, sure, but she drops one of the diamonds into the bucket of coal. Now, was that a thing? Did we have buckets of coal? And I've still seen people have, lots of wood next to their fireplaces, but a bucket of coal? Is that a New England thing,
If it is, it's before my time.
Ange?
Usually I think about it in like a stove. Like, I don't know if you would
Yeah.
want coal burning in just an open fireplace. My guess is that probably
If they
not.
had one of those old-fashioned stoves there,
Yeah,
maybe that
potbelly
would.
stove, something like that.
Supergirl's watching this with her supervision, and he's like, this confirms that you just created that diamond by squeezing it. And she says, you're right, I'm Supergirl. And now Supergirl's pissed because she's like, what? She's supposed to deny it. She can't, what? What? She just flat out stole my man. And that's the big cliffhanger for this episode.
Yeah, it's great. She goes, that is a deliberate lie. Lena knows she's not Supergirl, but why would she tell such an untruth? Is she turning into an arch criminal like her brother? She's got like a really stern look on her face. It's pretty funny.
I just have to mention at the bottom of this page, it's one of these three-quarter pages, there's an ad for a Teen Titans issue with a just fantastic cover by Nick Carty with Lilith being attacked by zombies or something, or great Nick Carty cover. Just had to point that out.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever met a Nick Carty Lilith cover that I didn't like.
So we're halfway through, and as I've mentioned, all these stories were by Leo Dorfman and Jim Mooney. We've already profiled Dorfman on the show a few months ago, so I'd like to learn a little bit more about Jim Mooney. Most of my sources are from Wikipedia and an article from Comic Book Artist. All the links to my sources will be in the show notes. So Jim Mooney was born in New York City in 1919, but raised in Los Angeles. He began his art career in the 30s in the California science fiction pulp magazine scene. He submitted his first drawings to Weird Tales and other magazines like that. He drew the cover for the first issue of Imagination, a fanzine that included Ray Bradbury's first published story, Hollenbachen's Dilemma. During this period, Mooney also met future comic book editors Mort Weisinger and Julius Schwartz, who had come to the area to meet some sci-fi authors. Remember, this is the time they were science fiction agents before they took the job at DC. After attending art school and working as a parking valet and other odd jobs, Mooney went to New York City in 1940 to enter that fledgling comic book field. Like a lot of the artists we profiled, Mooney started at Eisner and Iger, one of the studios that would supply outsourced comics to publishers, testing the waters of the new medium. He left voluntarily after just 2 weeks and said,
"I was just absolutely crestfallen when I looked at some of those guys' work. Lou Fine was working there, Nick Carty, and Eisner himself. I was beginning to feel that I was way, way in beyond my depth."
So Mooney then went on staff at Fiction House for approximately 9 months, working on features including Camilla and Suicide Smith, and becoming friends with colleagues George Tuska, Ruben Moreira, and Nick Carty. He began freelancing for Timely Comics, working on the line of Talking Animals and movie cartoon tie-in comics. As Mooney describes his being hired by Stan Lee for Timely,
"I met Stan the first time when I was looking for work at Timely. I came in, being somewhat young and cocky at the time, and Stan asked me what I did. I said I penciled. He said, 'What else?' I said I inked. He said, 'What else?' I said, 'Color.' Stan said, 'Do anything else?' I said, 'Yeah. I letter too.' He said, 'Do you print the damn books too?' I guess he was about 2 or 3 years my junior at that point. I think I was about 21 or 22.
Another good quote from the article in Comic Book Artist:
"Stan and I worked together until he was drafted. Later, we worked together when he was stationed at Duke University. I came down there to work with him on a Terry Toons project. We were on a tight deadline. So Stan found a place for me to work in a pathology lab. I was surrounded by jars of pickled eyeballs and various body parts. The incentive for me was to get out of there fast. That speeded me up tremendously."
In 1946, Mooney began a 22-year association with a company that would, of course, evolve into DC. He began with Batman as one of the ghost artists credited for Bob Kane. And as Mooney recalled coming to DC,
"The funny animal stuff was no longer in demand, and an awful lot of us were scurrying around looking for work. And I heard on the grapevine that they were looking for an artist to do Batman. So I buzzed up there to DC, talked to them, and showed them my stuff. And even though they weren't so sure because of my funny animal background, they gave me a shot at it. I brought the work in, and Whitney Ellsworth said, 'Okay, you're on.' Dick Sprang had taken off and had wanted to do something else, so that's where I fit in, and I stayed on Batman for quite a few years."
Mooney branched out to Superboy and other features such as Dial H for Hero and Tommy Tomorrow. I mentioned this on another episode. Recent DC Finest with Science Fiction Stories has a whole bunch of Tommy Tomorrow stories, all drawn by Jim Mooney, and the art in that is terrific too. They're fun stories. Big recommendation. Back to Mooney, he also contributed to at least a handful of 1953-54 issues of Lorna the Jungle Queen, published by Timely. Of course, most notably, Mooney drew the backup feature Supergirl in Action Comics from 1959 to 1968. It was 9 years. For much of this run on his signature character, Mooney lived in Los Angeles. He also managed an antiquarian bookstore on Hollywood Boulevard and sometimes hiring art students to work in the store and ink backgrounds on his penciled pages. He didn't always love working on the Supergirl strip, though.
"I wasn't terribly enthusiastic about the 9 years I spent on Supergirl. First of all, it was a strip that wasn't terribly challenging. After a while, you were pretty much doing the same thing over and over. The other thing I didn't like about it was, before that I was doing some stuff for DC, House of Mystery and so on, in a much more sophisticated style. When I started on Supergirl, Mort Weisinger insisted it had to be what he considered the house style. It had to look the way he wanted it, which was much simpler than the way I had been drawing previously. So I was pretty much fenced in by that particular requirement that Mort had. If I changed my style at all, he'd call me into his office and say, 'What are you trying to do? Make $1 million? Do you have somebody ghosting for you?' I said, 'No, I was just trying something a little bit different.' He said, 'Well, don't. Draw it the way you were drawing it before.'"
There's Mort Weisinger.
There's Mort Weisinger. Ever hear Paul Kupperberg say that? Mort Weisinger died, and somebody said, "There he lies, and lies, and lies, and lies." This is the Paul Kupperberg, he says. Mooney continues, "I'll give you an incident as an example. I'd been doing Supergirl for a long, long while, and I used to come in and bring my work to Mort. This would be about 1965. And I walked into the office, the door was open, and Mort was busy with a writer, and he waved me out like, 'I'm busy.' So I walked out to the bullpen, and I was talking to Jack Schiff, whom I'd worked with, and I think George Cashton, and Mort Boltonoff, and so on, and shooting the breeze, and Mort came storming in, absolutely storming in, and said, 'You're supposed to bring that Supergirl to me first.' His voice was cracking with anger, and I was flabbergasted. And everybody was shocked in the writer's bullpen, and he kept at it, saying, 'You know, you keep it this, and you won't be drawing Supergirl.' And I said, 'I've got news for you, Mort. I'm not going to be drawing Supergirl anymore.' He looked at me, totally stunned, and he stormed out of the office. Then, of course, there was a buzz in there, and Jack and Murray saying, "Don't worry, Jim, we'll get you some work, it's okay." And I said, "It's okay, you can only take so much of this." And I came in 2 weeks later to see Jack, and Mort comes down the hall with a script and says, "Here's your Supergirl script." Like nothing had ever happened. And I thought for a moment, well, don't be a damn fool. It's an income. And although I realized it would be as difficult as it ever was to work with that guy, I thought, I'll try it for a little longer.
Amazing, isn't it?
Amazing.
This guy got away with all this stuff. Anyway, by 1968, his time at DC was coming to an end. Remember, this was a year of big shakeups at DC. In his words,
DC was getting into the illustrative type of art then, primarily Neil Adams, and they wanted to go in that direction. Towards the end there, I picked up on it, and I think my later Supergirl was quite illustrative, but not quite what they wanted. I knew the handwriting was on the wall, so I was looking around. The reason I hadn't worked at Marvel for all those years was because they didn't pay as well as DC. I think at that time it was $30 a page, when I was getting closer to $50 a page at DC.
But by now, however, the rates were closer, and Mooney left DC. Stan Lee had hired him to work with the Amazing Spider-Man penciler John Romita. Mooney first worked on Spider-Man by inking the Spectacular Spider-Man magazine's two issues. That was a two-issue run where the first one's black and white, second one's color, and the pencils were by Romita, inks by Mooney. Mooney would go on to ink a run of Amazing Spider-Man from 65 to 88, which he recalled as
finalizing it over John's layouts.
Among the new characters introduced during Mooney's run were Randy Robertson as a member of the supporting cast and the Prowler. He also embellished John Buscema's pencils on many issues of The Mighty Thor. As a penciler, Mooney did several issues of Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, as well as stories in Marvel Team-Up, and he both penciled and inked issues of writer Steve Gerber's Man-Thing and the entire 10-issue run of Gerber's cult hit Omega the Unknown, among many other titles. Mooney named his collaborations with Gerber as being among his personal favorites. I found that interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Mooney also worked with Marvel-related coloring books for the child-oriented Spidey Super Stories and for a Spider-Man feature in a children's magazine spinoff of the PBS educational series The Electric Company, which included segments featuring Spider-Man. On the other end of the spectrum, in the late 1960s and early 70s, he also drew from bawdy Men's Adventure magazine comics features entitled Pussycat. That feature appeared in Men's Annual, Male Annual, and Stag magazines. A little different than these Supergirl stories,
for sure.
A one-shot of those stories did appear in 1968's The Adventures of Pussycat, and Mooney said,
"Stan wrote the first one I did, and then his brother Larry wrote the ones that came later."
By then, 1975, Mooney wanted to move to Florida, and he negotiated a 10-year contract with Marvel to supply artwork from there.
It was a good deal. The money wasn't too great, but I was paid every couple of weeks. I had insurance, and I had a lot of security that most freelancers never had.
That same year, Mooney and his wife Anne had a daughter, Noelle. Brett would say, "You dog, you," because Mooney was 56 at this time.
I can't even imagine.
In Florida, Mooney co-created Adventure Publications Star Rangers with writer Mark Ellis and worked on Superboy, the series based on the TV show. He also worked on Anne Rice's The Mummy and the creepy miniseries for Harris Comics. When Harris editor Richard Howell left to co-found Claypool Comics in 1993, Mooney produced many stories for the 166-issue run of Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, and became the regular inker on Peter David's Soul Searchers and Company over the pencils of Amanda Connor, Neil Vokes, John Hebank, and Dave Cockrum. He continued to work for Claypool until July 2006, when the company announced that the print end of its published line would cease. Mooney passed away on March 30th, 2008 in Florida after an extended illness. Mike's Amazing Worlds has him with 859 story credits of over 11,500 pages, which has none of this Claypool stuff in it. Wow. So he was just a giant in comics history. And, you know, I'm glad we got a chance to talk about him a little more.
You mentioned it, but basically he drew Action Comics 253. That's the second appearance of Supergirl, her first backup solo feature, and then draws her to 358. It is a crazy long run. And what I think is funny as part of this is that he says, like, oh, they were looking for a more illustrative style. The person that took over for him was Kurt Schaffenberger, which is also not illustrative, like, is not Neil Adams in any way, shape, or form. So I thought that was interesting. You know, he gave her all of those quirks of, like, the finger to the face and all of that sort of stuff, which I just love. And when I first started to work at the hospital that I'm working at now, there was an older physician there who was like, I hear you really like comic books. Is that true? And this guy is like one of those very wealthy physicians who has a lot of money, who like just gets commissions out of the wazoo. And he was
Very
like, who's your
cool.
favorite? And I was like, oh, Supergirl. And he was, I know Jim Mooney. I've gotten commissions from him. And so in the early 2000s, he said, I'll give you his address. You can contact him. So I have a Jim Mooney commission of Supergirl, which I'm sure is just him lightboxing and tracing. I'm sure that it's not a freehand sort of a thing, but it's her and Streaky flying in front of the moon. It's signed by
That's
Jim
cool.
Mooney, framed in my office at work. And the cool thing about it was that I was like, oh, I'm going to get a commission. It was something ludicrous. It was like $100, which
Wow.
you just think about it. It's so crazy. But it came in this huge, thick envelope, and in it was all of these prints and stats and things like that of like different Supergirl things that he had done. And I'm going to tell you, in it was a couple of randy ones of Supergirl. And if you read enough of his interviews, he says something like, so many people kept coming up to me and saying, can you draw a nude picture of Supergirl for me? And he's like, so I just did it for extra money. So there's like a bunch of her, like, I won't get into it too much. So it's great. And then the only other thing that I thought was really wonderful was that he drew her page in Who's Who in 1985. That's her headband costume. It's the first time he's ever drawn her. He hadn't drawn her since Action Comic 358, 1969, something like that. And I thought that that was just a very good nod to sort of history, which I think Who's Who tried to do.
They really did. They tried to get those original artists wherever they could. So that's great.
And thank goodness they didn't give it to Carmen Infantino, who was like the last person, because she would just be there with her arms on her hips, with her legs spread wide, like every other Carmen Infantino page of Who's Who.
Right.
So I thought that was just great.
Well, that's awesome. Glad that you've had that interaction. That's really amazing. All right, so let's move on. Ready to do the second half of our mini trade?
Yes.
So the third story is called The Forbidden Weapons of Krypton, another 13-pager. So take it away, Ange.
So back to our cliffhanger. Why was Lena telling Dick that she was Supergirl? Well, it turns out that Les Lalar has escaped captivity in Kandor, and she used a mind control device to make Lena say that and then exchanged places with her. We'll get back to that in a second. She even unleashes an anti-monitor bomb, no, not that anti-monitor, that stops all communications between Kandor and Earth so that the Kandorian authorities cannot contact Superman or Supergirl to let them know that Lesla is missing. This fake Lena shows Supergirl that she has superpowers, explaining them away as another one of Lex's schemes gone wrong. When Supergirl goes away, Lesla then releases three prisoners out of the Phantom Zone, General Zod, Jack Sura, and Cruel. Cruel retrieves a box of forbidden weapons from Krypton, more on that later, that happened to sink in the ocean on Earth. Cruel tests one of the weapons on Les Lalar, disintegrating her. More on that later. But the weapon had a side effect of raising Atlantis out of the sea. Welcome to the Silver Age.
I love this one.
Yeah. After fixing the Atlantis problem, Supergirl learns from Lori Lamaris about the Les Lalar switch and the Phantom Zone villains. Supergirl says she will go find Superman, who is somewhere in the past, but can't time travel due to a barrier erected around Earth by the villains. Jack Sura then exposes Supergirl to a virus, which causes all animals near her to be transformed into plants, meaning she can't go near anybody living. So Supergirl has to separate herself from all animal life. The villains then plan on conquering Earth, and she can't stop them. She realizes there is only one person on Earth she can turn to help, Batman. No, she one person that she turns to is Lex Luthor.
Mort Weisinger would never have gone towards Batman. All right, this is a wild one. I'm not even sure where to start. You get a nice recap in the first two pages of the preceding stories.
Yes.
Where Linda's telling her parents, she's just really annoyed about this, which I thought was great.
Yeah, super annoyed. And I'll tell you, in one of the first stories, there's one panel where she says, you know what I should just do? I should tell Dick Melvin that she's a Luthor. And the mother's like, no, like she probably has a good reason. And so it's that same level of annoyance. The parents are like, she was probably joking. Don't be so mean.
Trying to impress a boy. It's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But then we get the Les Lalar sequence. Why don't you walk us through that, Ange? Because that's a complicated setup.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you, it's crazy. And the thing about it is the same plot that Lesla used when she first fought Supergirl, which is back in 282. She wants to escape Kandor. She realizes, Lesla, that if I escape Kandor, they're going to be Les Lalar is gone and they'll go looking for her. So she has to swap, right? She has to have somebody take her place. So just as she did to Supergirl. She has a mind control ray. She then says, Lena looks enough like me that we can switch. She then shrinks Lena, puts her in like a mental helmet to make Lena believe that she's Lesla. And then Lesla then leaves Kandor, enlarges herself, and takes over the life of Lena Luthor, which is exactly what she did to Supergirl in that earlier story. There's actually a story where Linda is acting as Lesla on Kandor. It's really crazy.
It almost worked once. Maybe she figured she'd try it again, right? So
yeah, why not? Another girl who looks just like me? Done. Yeah.
So then Supergirl came over to talk to Lena, who's really Lesla, about why she told Dick this. And then she shows her that she's got superpowers. And then she gets a snazzy outfit of her own, sort of purple and darker
and
purple. Yeah, an orange cape and some gloves. That's when she starts to talk to the Phantom Zone. She just turned a television set into a Phantom Zone projector. I always thought they were a little harder to make than that, because they're, you know, whenever they get destroyed, it's like, oh, it's a big deal. But she just turns one of a TV into one. So I don't know. You're the expert on that.
Yeah, it's really crazy. To my super scientific brain, this television is but a child's toy. But you're exactly right. Unlike the standard, oh, this is a radar dish that I'm holding in my hands, it looks like a vanity mirror, which I think it has to be. This was sold to for girls. So
yeah, it's fabulous. She then makes them each give a little summary of a bad thing they did, which I thought was fabulous.
Yeah.
That's a way to introduce each of these characters to the reader a little bit. They come through, and then I love the cameo by Mon-El. Starts to come through. She's like, no, not you, and shoves him back in the poor Mon-El.
Yeah, I think it's great. So first of all, she's like, I can't release all of you. I only want the three worst of you. So tell me what you did. And then Mon-El comes in and, you know, you got to give her some credit. She's prepared. She's like, I brought this gun that ejects lead dust because you're invulnerable to lead, to sort of like make him recoil and go back into the thing. She was prepared. Good for her.
That's fantastic. So then they set up a time barrier. So Superman's for some reasons in the past. So they set up a barrier around Earth so that Superman can't come back. So all they have to deal with is Supergirl. And there, of course, no other heroes around to help Supergirl.
That device is in this vault of forbidden weapons.
I forgot about that. Let's talk about the vault of forbidden weapons.
And that's actually a callback to the first issue that the Phantom Zone Ray was discovered, which is Adventure Comics 283, where Superboy discovers a vault of forbidden weapons that was shot into space that lands on Earth. You don't know it's by Cruel back then. This is actually Cruel's first appearance, but all of those things, the mental helmet, the disintegrator ray, the Phantom Zone ray, are all in that vault. So this is like a little bit of continuity within the story.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that one. That's awesome. So they set up the ray. That's the first thing. And then they say, all right, we have to test this vaporizer gun. We'll draw straws for it, and Lena loses, and they just disintegrate her.
Yeah, they just disintegrate Lesla.
Lesla, not Lena.
They're like, we're going to use this ray to kill Superman, but we don't know if it'll work because he's invulnerable, so we're going to have to try it on one of us. Draw straws. And it's great because she's like, but wait, it was I who freed you from the Phantom Zone. And they're like, enough of your whining. And they just disintegrate her. She's just evaporated.
Was this the last time we saw Lesla Lar pre-crisis?
No. This is what's so cool about this. And again, I'm going to wave my Supergirl nerd flag.
Yeah,
if you read the Superman Family, the dollar comic, there's this whole section of Supergirl stories where there's like a disembodied voice and it takes over a robot and then it takes over a different robot. And then that turns out to be the spirit of Lesla Lar has survived all of this time and wants her revenge. And ultimately they fight again on the mental landscape where they fight one more time. So it's not the last time that we see.
Amazing.
Just amazing.
So then the whole thing with Atlantis, they had to throw Atlantis in this for some reason. One of the weapons causes Atlantis to come out of the ocean, the mermaid half of Atlantis. So we get Lori Lamaris there, and Supergirl makes a giant backhoe thing, scoop.
Yeah.
Dig the dirt out so Atlantis will sink back and so that all the mermaid people don't drown.
Yeah.
So then she takes off to try to find Superman. That's when she discovers the time barrier. And then she comes to fight the three bad guys and throws a tree at them. I'm like, girl, that's not going to do much.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think at first they're like, oh my God, she's throwing a tree. But then they're like, wait,
what are we afraid of? We're super now. And they just let them explode on her.
Right. And so they just have kind of a standoff until Jack Sewer.
No, it's Cruel for
sure. Oh, it's Cruel. I'm sorry. It's Cruel. Cruel shines a ray from a belt weapon onto her, and she walks by birds and they start turning into plants. What a random weapon.
What a random weapon. I'll say the thing that I like about this is that, remember, it's three evil people, grown men with superpowers, and Supergirl in one panel basically says, no matter what you try to do, I'm going to be able to stop you. It's going to be a standoff. One of her against three of them, which I think is pretty bold, but might be true. And so that's when he's, oh yeah? We'll make it so that you can't go near anybody. We'll shine this ray on you.
So Supergirl goes to this deserted island in the middle of the ocean and decides the only person who can help is Lex. And at first he says, forget it. Why would I want to help you? But your sister is trapped in Kandor and she's going to stay there stuck forever unless you help. And he says, fine. And I love the end. Lex says, Supergirl, I'm against truth, justice, and everything else you stand for. But to save Lena, I promised you my last atom of brain power to help you against those Kryptonian goons. Agreed, Luthor. And that's the cliffhanger to the next episode. This one was a wild one.
Yeah, I just love the fact that it's like, oh, wait, but what about that disintegrator ray? So they kill Les Lalar with the disintegrator ray, and then it's like, oh, it only had one shot. I guess we can't use this, right? Because if not, they'd kill Supergirl and Superman. So all of these plot points that are like dropped in, and then, oh, Atlantis, save us, because Atlantis is up there. Oh, no, oh, by the way, I was peeking out of the water, and I saw Leslo let these guys out. So it turns out she's not really Lena, she's Les Lalar, right? So all of these sort of
all those things, They just packed a lot of story into 13 pages.
Yeah.
All right, let's finish it off. So the fourth story, the superpowers of Lex Luthor, yet another 13 pages. So Luthor has agreed to help Supergirl against the Phantom Zone criminals, but her super ventriloquism did not convince the jail warden to release him. Instead, Cruel approaches Luthor and promises to free Lena from Kandor if Luthor teams up with them instead. Even better, he gives Luthor superpowers. Supergirl's last resort has failed. After making himself a snazzy purple and green super outfit, Lex joins the criminals on the island where they demonstrate more of the super weapons. The Phantom Zone villains plot behind Luthor's back, though, to use gold kryptonite not just against Supergirl and Superman, but Luthor too. They lure Supergirl and Luthor and expose them to the gold K, and they lose their powers. The villains then eliminate the barrier, and Superman falls prey as well. But it has all been a bluff. Luthor, of course, overheard them plotting against him with his super hearing. He and the L cousins still have their powers and defeat the villains. Supergirl used one of the weapons to create another Phantom Zone projector, sending the villains back to the zone. Superman and Supergirl then destroy the box of forbidden weapons, and as a result, Supergirl is cured from the virus and Lex loses his powers. He abides by his truce to return to jail as long as Lena is reduced from Kandor. The end. Whew!
Yeah, another doozy. He loses his powers because Cruel's belt isn't there. The plant scourge goes away because the belt isn't there anymore, so she's not going to turn things into crazy stuff. And there's one part at the very end when we get there that I think is just somebody must have screwed up. You know, at the end, they're like, oh, we have to release Lena, but she's here. And he's like, no, I made a Lena android to help me operate the exchange ray. And then the robot, it's like, I think Mooney must have drawn her in a little bit too early, because then the next panel we see her flying out. I thought that was funny.
That is funny. I guess they needed something to exchange with her to get her out of Kandor, not counting all the millions of times people get shrunken and enlarged coming in and out of Kandor. Yeah. So let's talk about it a little bit. What'd you think of Luthor busting out of the prison? It's not bad plot twist that he's, I can't get out on the good, so I'll accept the bad guy's offer. So I thought that was a good turn for Luthor. Yeah. He is still a bad guy.
Yeah, I thought it was great. And it shows that they respect Luthor's brain, that they're like, why not join us? So I thought that was pretty cool. And he immediately busts out of the cell, stands there, lets them shoot him, uses heat vision to melt the rays. And then I love, he's like, well, I may as well put on a snazzy suit. So goes to the Superman Museum, and I guess there's just some alien mannequin there. And he's like, I'm going to adopt this suit, but I'll put a little LL.
Yeah. I love the LL and the green cape.
Yes, yes. And then you see in that panel, by the way, the imitation gold kryptonite. Right.
That I did notice.
Oh, why is that there? I bet, you know, it's like Chekhov's gold kryptonite.
So. Yes, Chekhov's gold kryptonite. That's great. So then Supergirl has a little reminiscing. She's I failed. Remember these times I did good deeds of Supergirl? Are these real past adventures?
I don't think these are real past adventures. And I'm going to tell you. So the first one is, remember those times you fought the metal androids of Asteroid X? I don't think that's real. And then the next one, where they destroyed the Porcupine Planet. If you look at the cover of Superman number 144, I think this is a lift, because in that cover, they're looking at, they've gone back in time to see Krypton explode, and they're in the exact same position. So I think a little bit of a lift.
Very clever. So then Luthor goes to the island where the villains are demonstrating. And I love the scene of the army, which says that this is the epicenter of the earthquake that they had caused. And they run off the dinghy that they used to land on the island, and they turn into cavemen.
Yeah, this is a tremendous cachet of forbidden weapons. First of all, he has a helmet that anything he thinks of becomes real. He makes a giant spider that he then dissipates. And then he's like, we'll use our time reversal ray. And it's amazing. They run on board. And then all of a sudden they're in shaggy clothes with clubs instead of army gear. But they've kept their brains, which I think is funny, because they're like, let's get into our canoe. Their motorboat has become a canoe.
It's too funny. So they check on the fact that neither Superman nor the Legion of Superheroes from the future can break through the time barrier. So Luthor's like, that's pretty smart. But then we see the scene while Luthor's watching that, the three villains are plotting against him and saying, yeah, we'll get rid of this guy once we don't need him anymore. Right then I'm like, well, Luthor can hear them. I'm like, he's not even that far away.
Not even that far away. I could probably hear them without super hearing.
So they say, well, Luthor, you got to go and create something and get this gold kryptonite. That's another thing that's buried in the bottom of the ocean. So Luthor creates a machine, but we find out later, of course, that he had replaced it with the fake gold kryptonite from the museum. And then Luthor and Supergirl come. And I found it interesting. It didn't occur to me until my second or third time. Supergirl, if she's exposed to any animals, they turn into plants, but not other people.
Yeah.
None of the Kryptonians get turned into plants. And she's all around them before she's been cured from the virus.
Yeah, the no prize, which doesn't make much sense, is that, like, could it be that when she gets exposed to gold kryptonite and loses her powers, that for some reason that affects that? But I don't think it works, because then later she's like, oh, I've been cured. It would have been too gruesome to have people turn into plants. So
yeah, maybe that was
animals.
It. But then they show, and a clever bit of wording, Supergirl says, Superman's coming. So they let the barrier down. They expose Luthor and Supergirl to the gold kryptonite. The Phantom Zone villains let the barrier down so Superman can come. Supergirl says, she thinks, Superman's coming. I've got to warn him. But using my superpowers is out of the question. It's because we think, oh, she doesn't have superpowers anymore. But no, of course, it's out of the question because she doesn't want to give up the...
That's right.
Wait, I have it. This mirror from the pouch of my cape. She carries around. She must carry around a mirror to check her perfect hairstyle all the time.
Yes.
Right? And so she flashes a message to Superman. And we don't quite find out what that is. It says it's Morse code or something. Beware of danger. Criminals have escaped Phantom Zone. You can help us by... But we don't see the end of how they think Superman can help us.
Yes.
So then he comes in and he falls to the ground, and the bad guys think that they're all at their mercy. They show them the big cache of weapons, which Superman then zaps into non-existence immediately because he hasn't really lost his powers.
And it's a triple heat vision. Lex, Supergirl,
triple
and
version,
Superman,
yeah.
All just melting the whole thing.
But weren't they from Krypton? Are they supposed to, sometimes Krypton stuff can't be destroyed.
Yeah. I will tell you, are you one of the many who read Superman the 30s to the 70s?
Did
you
have that book? I have that. It's on my shelf out there. Yes. I still have my copy.
One of the stories in there is he gets exposed to red kryptonite. He grows a huge beard and long hair.
Yep.
And in that they say, we need three heat visions to destroy Kryptonian things, right? That's why Krypto, Supergirl, and Superman give them a shave with heat vision. So I think that that's in continuity. You need three levels of heat vision to destroy invulnerable things from Krypton.
I will accept that. That's very good. I love it. I'm going to have to pull that book out and read it. So then we see the reverse of the scene where Lex overheard the other villains plotting. But the one weapon that hasn't been destroyed yet is the mind over matter machine, which is just laying there on the ground. Anybody could have grabbed it.
Yeah, it's a
most
little bit
powerful
ridiculous.
One.
Right? Yeah, why would you ever take it off your head? I don't know, just and throw it on the beach. So...
So she then uses it to create a Phantom Drone projector and sends them back. And we find that that has cured her. And Lex says, my superpowers have gone too. I'll honor my deal. I wonder if his superpowers hadn't gone away, if he would have honored his deal. If He would have just gone and tried to free Lena. I believe he still would have cared about her, but, you know, then he would have been superpowered Lex. That would have been interesting for another chapter.
For sure.
So then we get the scene you were talking about where there's Lena there, but it's not her, it's the android, and you see the little tiny Lena coming out, who still doesn't know that she's Lex's sister, which I thought that was pretty clever of the way that they were able to maintain that for a while more. So I thought that was great.
She doesn't learn that she's Luthor's sister until those dollar comics in the Superman family. And I will tell you why. She gets cancer. She gets chemo. She goes bald. And when she sees her bald self in the mirror, she's like, the physical resemblance. I must be Lex's sister. I look just like
him. Unbelievable. I think that's it. Final thoughts on this whole story?
No, I thought it was absolutely great. It gave her, Supergirl that is, her first rogue. This was Lesla. She almost, you know, succeeded. She really almost succeeds here. It's a lot of luck is needed to sort of defeat.
Yeah.
And then you and I think when we did the DC special All Girls, talked about the Black Flame,
yes,
which you might remember was Lesla Lar's lab partner,
right,
who was
right
out for revenge. And all of these characters, Lesla Lar, as I said, is in the current book and is sort of turned up now and then. Lena is still around. This is stuff that's in the foundation of DC and in Supergirl's history for sure.
Well, I have to say, this has inspired me. I gave the two Supergirl Silver Age omnibuses to my daughter years ago for Christmas or something. And so I think I'm going to go read them because I've read these in not in a continuous way, like a continuous story like that. So this is, you know, this has really inspired me to take that on as a reading challenge later this year, probably. That was great. I highly enjoyed these stories. They're just wacky.
Yeah, complete ton of fun. And how fun to see that it is, like you said, one story, right? You know, four issues, but one.
This is a very satisfying giant size comic book, you know?
Yeah.
I love anthologies. I love stories of all different characters in these giant size specials, but it's very satisfying story when you sit there. This would have taken some kid all afternoon to read.
For sure.
So I think it's great. But we're not done, listeners, because we have a special feature. We have a 3-page special feature illustrated by Mike Sikowski, who was the artist of the Supergirl series at the time. And there are costumes designed by readers, but I think rendered by Sikowski. And they're all done in like a paper doll way, but without the little tabs. Like there's no Supergirl in her underwear for you to
put
them on top of, but they're all empty suits with no person inside, which I found that fascinating. So what are your favorite ones from the feature here, Ange?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I'll say is, you know, there is a Supergirl who is announcing them.
Right.
And that blue skirt with the belt and the high boots is the same one that was in the table of contents,
right,
which of course she was wearing now and then. There's like a groovy pantsuit that I think just screams 70s in 1961. That looks like something Mrs. Brady would wear. So I think
the one by Janet Hallinan of Orange, California. Janet, if you're listening, let us know. We thought that was groovy. It's got like the collar's like Dr. Strange collar, you know.
It's amazing. And then on the second page, there's like a skirt that has like a crisscross red ribbon with just a red S. There's no like S symbol or anything like that by Joan Bevers that I think is cool. And then on the last page, I think this one by Jeanette Majural of Cadillac, Michigan. It looks almost like a one-piece bathing suit with red glove and a red cape and high boots. I think all of those are cool.
I'm interested by the fact of how many of them have gloves.
Must have been the fashion back then.
Superman, Supergirl, they never, you know, most of the super families never wear gloves. This is not Batman, right? This is the Superman family. They don't generally wear gloves, but she's got gloves on in this outfit you like, the 70s mod one. But many of the costumes illustrated have gloves. Jumped out at me. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. And I'll say again, I'm just going to keep tooting the horn of the current book, but in one of the earliest issues of that book, her costume gets destroyed. She has moved back to Midvale and she's like, well, let me look at all of the old costumes that I have. And there's literally some of the ones that we see here.
That's fantastic.
That she tries on.
I'm going to have to read the series now. This sounds great.
Yeah. And I'm going to say one of the things that I always say is so many times it seems like DC puts a writer on Supergirl who doesn't like the character. It's very clear that Sophie Campbell is, I am going to immerse myself in her history and do my best to honor that in a way that isn't repetitive, but just acknowledges what's happening. Mm-hmm.
The one you didn't mention that I thought was kind of cool is a pantsuit on the second page by Raejeanne Finley of Decatur, Illinois.
Yeah.
It's like all blue with red boots underneath, but there's multiple S symbols going around the sort of midriff and with a vest instead of a cape. I just thought that was very 70s.
A vest cape and what looks to be bell bottom.
It's fantastic.
So that's pretty cool.
So anyway, I love this little, I'll put all three pages in the gallery for everybody to look at and comment on. Let me know your favorite costume of these three pages, listeners, and tell us in the comments. That would be fantastic. So, Ange, that's pretty much it. So I think I know your answer, but did this comic live up to its special billing?
Yeah, this is truly a special book. I'm so happy that I have it in my collection. And I think for all of the reasons that we talked about. And again, I'll just say, there's a lot of Superman history in these stories. The fact that you learn, why is General Zod and those things, there was no internet back then. You learned that stuff. You learned Lex Luthor's origin, General Zod's origin, Jack Sir's origin, all of those things within this story. And Dick Melvin's just a dick.
I was wondering what she saw in him anyway. Ange, thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it. Can you tell everybody where else they might find you or be able to interact with you?
For sure. I'm on X and Blue Sky as Dr. Ange70. I run my Supergirl site called Comic Box Commentary, where I review current issues and old issues and sort of try to talk all things Supergirl. And you can frequently find me sometimes as a co-host right here on the Fire and Water Network. So recently I've been on The Fantastic Four and MASHcast, and now DC SpecialCast.
Well, thanks again, Ange. I really appreciate it. Now I'm going to play a short promo. When I return, you'll hear the next installment of The Monthly Planet with Sean M. Myers, plus my next episode announcement and listener feedback. So stay tuned.
Hello there. Come on in and welcome to The Fantastic Four. I am your host, Brett Young, and this is the podcast serving up comics, cocktails, and conversation for your listening pleasure. Every episode, I'll welcome a guest to the Fantastic Lounge to explore one of their favorite comic book characters and cover a classic story in which they're featured. And what pairs better with great literature than a delicious drink? Based on my guest's ingredient of choice, we'll mix up a cocktail or mocktail to enjoy in the Fantastic Lounge while we talk comics, mixology, history, and whatever else comes to mind. So join me every month for the Fantastic Pour. Open for business by the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome back. I am Sean M. Myers, your co-editor-in-chief of The Monthly Planet. In this segment, Paul and I will discuss the beloved series of DC House ads, The Daily Planet, that ran in the back pages of DC Comics from 1976 to 1981. This month, we are discussing the issues from 50 years ago, June 1976.
And as always, we want to acknowledge our favorite website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. If you click on Galleries and then Daily Planet, you can read all the issues of the Daily Planet there.
And don't forget to follow our Blue Sky account, The Monthly Planet, for the issues and other fun. Okay, the first one up this month is the week of June 7th, 1976. Batman assassinates Superman.
Bum, bum, bum.
Caped Crusader slays Man of Steel in Kandor. And then they tell you, this is from Kandor. How Do You Kill a Superman is the title of the story in World's Finest number 240. And it poses a tough question for Batman when the President of the United States orders him to assassinate the Man of Steel. Why, you ask, is Superman, the world's greatest hero, the target in a murder? Seems he's been undergoing a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde transformation, and his evil side has been responsible for untold amounts of damage to property all over the world. So it's into Superman's fortress and down to miniature size for the Caped Crusader as he must track down Superman inside the Bottle City of Kandor. Luckily for Batman, Superman and the other Kryptonians in the bottle have no powers there, or he'd never succeed. You won't want to miss the surprising ending to the shocker story by Bob Haney, Dick Dillon, and John Callahan when it hits the stands the week of June 14th.
This is the time when Bob Haney was writing World's Finest, and man, there's some wacky stuff. This is a good one. I actually remember this when I had this one. Did you read this one this month, Sean?
Yeah, so I'll be honest, could be like the print quality of when I printed out The Planet. The graphic kind of looks like a 1960s World's Finest, and there's nothing wrong with 60s World's Finest.
No, I get you.
But I was super happy when I saw the cover and I saw, oh no, it's much more modern. Modern being 50 years old of the comic. So spoiler alert, oh my God, of what I've read, to prep for Daily Planet. This was fantastic.
Yeah.
I loved it. And it's funny because I didn't realize Bob Haney wrote it. But now that I know Bob Haney wrote it, oh yeah, now I get this. Because man, crazy stuff happens. And there is no way you would know who the villain of this story is. Because when they says like a shocker, yeah, I was shocked. That is absolutely true. I loved it. I'm not going to spoil it anyway. It's fantastic.
I agree, 100%. Good one to lead off the month with, for sure.
Joker and Catwoman fight over kidnap victims. Gotham City. When a famous movie comedian like Benny Springer teams up with his equally famous cat to make a new hit movie, you can be sure that both stars will be the targets for a kidnapping. Determined to ruin the comedian's good name by taking his place, the Joker plans to snatch Springer at the first screening of the new film. But the crown prince of crime is beaten to the punch by the Catwoman, who takes both Benny and the cat. But it's not long before the Joker is on her trail, and then the battle begins. You won't want to miss the epic battle between the cat and the clown by Elliot Magan, Irv Novik, and Tex Blaisdell in The Joker number 9 on sale the week of June 14th.
Yeah, so this one I read last night because I just got my copy of The Joker, DC Finest.
That's what I was waiting for, yeah.
It's in there. This is the last published issue of The Joker. It's another wacky one. Some of those Joker issues are just flat out silly. They really did not know what to do because they felt very constrained by the comics code that the villain had to lose at the end. So it's not like a modern comic where you read like one of the Joker series from a couple of years ago. It's so Silver Age-y in that Catwoman's after the cat. The cat is smart. And at the end, the comedian dresses up like the Joker as in a reversal. Catwoman doesn't know who. They say, oh, we know how to prove who's who by letting the cat choose because he's going to go to his owner. Well, of course, the cat is trained if he has a certain signal not to go to the owner. And he goes to the Joker and he's sent back to the Arkham Asylum. Ha ha. Hacienda. So it's just a wacky story.
That almost reminds me of, is it Joker's five-way revenge? What's the Marshall Rogers where the cat goes to the owner?
I also read that, because that's one of the first stories in that book, is the five-way revenge. That's Neil Adams, and that's the one with the shark and Batman and the guy in the wheelchair are trapped in the tank, and Batman has to smash out of the tank. I don't remember a cat in that.
There's a really famous Joker story where he says that he's going to kill certain people, I think probably by midnight. It's something like the poison before 24 hours.
Yeah.
But there's a cat in that one because someone's dressed up like Batman, right? And someone's dressed up like the cat.
I haven't read those in a little while.
The cat goes to quote unquote Batman because it's actually the owner, but the cat has like the Joker grin on him. Yeah.
I'm sure number one Joker fan Rob McCarthy will let us know where we have misspoken on that one.
The Joker issues, I have the vast majority of them, but not all of them. So I'm really looking forward to getting that Joker Finest.
Well, this one just came. My batches are different timing than yours, I think. But yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to wait for the Dead Man to come out, which is like, I guess, 2 weeks from now. And then, so it's, I think, Dead Man Western, Sergeant Rock. It doesn't matter.
Anyway.
The next one is Weird War Leads Nazi Soldiers to Ultimate Destiny. And this is from Weird War number 48. And I've never read Weird War.
I have read a couple of these. If you look at the second paragraph there, it talks about traveling with Steve Skeets and Buddy Grinnell into the future for another episode of The Day After Doomsday. And these were very short. Some of them were only 2 or 4 pages, sort of post-apocalyptic views into the future. I've read a couple of them. And I don't remember where. I don't know if they were collected or I happened to have a random issue of this or what. But that stuck out at me because I do know that there was like a run of those, a series of those. I don't know, it was half a dozen or a dozen or what, but that are somewhat well regarded.
Because back then, I wouldn't have read any of this. Now I'll read anything and everything. I'll read Western. I'll read war. I'll read romance. I'll read
the Western DC Finest I just finished the other day. Fantastic. I really enjoyed it a lot.
All right. That'll be my next batch.
Yep.
Okay, now we're going to flip over to the direct currents. On sale the week of June 14th, Justice League number 134, and that's The Battle at the Edge of Forever. Our Fighting Forces number 169, and that has Welcome Home and Die, plus Johnny Cloud flies solo after the sign in the sky. Black Hawk number 248, and that's Operation Overkill. A title called DC Superstars number 7. Aquaman and Aqualad swim into their own giant collection. The King of the Sea finds himself trapped between two dooms. And then Aqualad flies solo in Some Call It Noise. Now, I actually have that issue. Got it years later from this. Would that be eligible for?
Absolutely. That is on the list. Not scheduled at this point, but it is definitely on the list. I don't know who I'd get to talk about that. I'm not sure anybody likes Aquaman.
And last but certainly not least, the trivia quiz number 6.
I'm ready. I did not look ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I don't either. Like the rest of us, superheroes have relatives. Do you know the family relations between, number one, Billy Batson and Mary Marvel? Number two, Superman and Supergirl? Number three, Iris Allen and Kid Flash? Number four, Hawkman and Hawk Girl?
These are pretty easy.
These are pretty easy, yeah. What's the family relations between Billy Batson and Mary Marvel?
They are brother and sister.
Correct. Superman and Supergirl?
They are cousins.
Yes. Iris Allen and Kid Flash?
She is his aunt.
Yes. Hawkman and Hawkgirl.
They are married.
Yes.
That was pretty easy. All right, we're going to move on to the week of June 14th, 1976. And the headline, Batgirl Kidnapped. Batman Family number 7. Sean and I covered this issue, just for those of you who want to be completists. I looked it up. Batman Family Reunion number 7 came out July of 2022. Sean, that was 4 years ago that we covered this issue. Holy cow. I could go back and listen to that and not remember anything I said, I'm sure.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
But I will read the synopsis here too, that people can know what we were talking about. In Washington, D.C., Batgirl, the only costume crime fighter currently operating in the nation's capital, has been kidnapped by Mr. and Mrs. Menace of the underworld, the Sportsmaster and the Huntress. By luring the Domino Daredevil to a local bank with the report of a robbery in progress, the pair of evildoers were able to trap her and transport her to the site of ancient ruins in Mexico. Because, of course you do. And clever criminals that they are, they calculated that Robin, who worked time to time with Batgirl, would hear of her disappearance and would soon be on their trail. Similar trap was laid for Team Wonder, and though he did not fall into it, he arrived where the villains wanted him just the same. What is the perfidious plan of these two master criminals? They've got them playing an ancient Olympic sports, and for the winner, it's 13 points to a dead end. Who will be the unlikely winner, and who will be the lucky loser? And that will all be answered in this Elliot Magan, Kurt Swan, Vince Coletta masterwork in Batman Family number 7. Yeah, we don't need to talk about it a lot, because we probably talked for 2 hours about it 4 years ago. But this was a great one.
And Paul, I think, is purposefully burying the lead so that I can tell everybody that this is the very first comic book I ever bought.
Yes.
Off of the newsstands.
Yeah, I thought I'd let you tell everybody that.
And I loved it. So I read this story 50 years ago, read it hundreds of times since then. As Paul was reading that recap, each of the panels like is burned into my memory, seared into my memory, which next month I'll talk about like a book I read 2 days ago and I don't remember anything about it. Like, I just love, love, love this story. I love this issue. I can't say enough great things about it. The other nice thing is, I guess, starting now, maybe I will be able to talk about, oh, I got that book off of the stands at the time.
Yep, because now you have started collecting comics. Again, if you want to hear more of us go on and on about this, pull up Batman Family Reunion number 7. I'm sure you'll have fun, because we did.
Yeah.
The next sort of headline one was the Fatal Five Battle, the Legion of Superheroes. And in the 30th century, the most deadly foes of the Legion, the Fatal Five, are back. And they've attacked Duplicate Boy, the hero of the planet Lalor. It's all a result of their mysterious plan involving a number of very strange space capers that the Legion members are determined to stop. You've got Jim Shooter and Mike Grell on this one in a full-length plunder ploy of the Fatal Five in Superboy number 219. It's got a great Mike Grell cover that we can see down there. Pretty cool. Did you have this one?
So not at the time. I'm going through and getting all of the Legion after Kurt Swan left. So I may have this. I may not. And through the years, some of them I have read. I'm kind of getting them all together to do like a massive, like mega read once. Yeah.
This might be, if not the very first, one of the very earliest issues of the Legion that I bought. That's what drew me in, was the micro art.
It's funny, because I was talking about how the issue before this, like the World's Finest, like how it's printed out in small, how I felt maybe that art wasn't great. Even shrunken down and in not like a great print, I can see how nice that Superboy cover looks.
Yep. And then the last paragraph is, Superman is joining the Justice Society to battle Xanadu. Now, not Olivia Newton-John.
I know, that's a shame, because that song is fantastic.
No getting physical either, Sean. But Superman does come back to the Justice Society. This is obviously on Earth 2 and takes place in All-Star Comics number 62. Can the Man of Steel still cut the mustard with the Super Squad? That's by Jerry Conway, Paul Levitz, Keith Giffen, and Wally Wood. You learn more about Dr. Fate as he lies dying in the JSA headquarters. This one's recently covered on the Earth 2 podcast a couple of months ago. Great, great storyline. Terrific art. We got very early Keith Giffen, really an interesting time for the JSA.
I have this run of All-Star. I really like it. I think it's very nice.
Mm-hmm. And then the Direct Current's on sale the week of June 21st is GI Combat 194 with the Haunted Tank and the OSS. The only thing I want to say about the OSS is I never really read that until I read the issue of Showcase that came out, last issue of Showcase. And I remember enjoying that. OSS, of course, is the precursor to CIA. Tarzan 253, continuing the adaptation of Tarzan the Untamed. The Flash 244, the top is dead. But unless the Rogues Gallery can stop his plans, it's the last day of June, it's the last day of Central City. This was a great run of The Flash, where the top died, the Rogues are out for revenge, and then we find out that Captain Cold's sister was his girlfriend, and it's just great stuff, great stuff. Unexpected 175, with some tales of unexpected shock and excitement. And then Adventure number 447 with an Aquaman story and a Creeper story. I had forgotten that the Creeper had a few issues of Adventure Comics, because I recently was reading some of the flashback issues, because I'm doing a Flash Bronze Age reread this year. Everybody remembers Firestorm, and then everybody remembers Dr. Fate. But then there was like four or five issues after Dr. Fate left where the Creeper was in the Flash. I don't know if you knew that.
That's really where I first fell in love with Firestorm. And plus, that was my introduction to George Perez.
Yeah.
It's funny because I had a subscription to The Flash at the time, and I liked it. But then when Firestorm came on, I didn't realize, like, oh my God, like, I love Firestorm more than I love Flash. And it's also, that I think that's really the first time I took notice of different art styles.
Yep, because it's very apparent.
Yeah, George Perez, and you had Don Heck. When Firestorm left the book, I dropped Flash, and I don't know, probably switched my subscription to a digest, probably. But I didn't know that Creeper had issues in The Flash.
Yeah, I just read them last week.
And now, the Creeper stories in Adventure, were they new?
Well, it's not by Ditko, so it's by Pesco, Estrada, and Staten, so they've got to be a new story. All right, Sean, you ready for the trivia quiz? Over the years, there have been quite a few Earths that have been established in DC Comics. Do you know which ones the following DC superstars are located? Power Girl, The Creeper, Captain Marvel, Uncle Sam, and Carrie Bates. So, Sean, here we go. First one, Power Girl.
Power Girl's Earth 2.
The Creeper.
Earth 1.
All right, that's correct. Captain Marvel Jr.
Earth S.
Very good. Uncle Sam.
Earth X.
Well, that's a trick question. He started on Earth X.
Because now he's on Earth 1.
What did they say in the answer?
Flip over, yeah.
Uncle Sam came from Earth X to Earth 1. So, you got half credit on that one. And Carrie Bates.
So this is hilarious. I did not plan this. I think we should just record me saying I do not get paid to promote DC Finest collections. Literally, I was on the porch reading the Flash collection, and there is the story. I forget what it's called, but it's the one where Carrie Bates is driving into...
Yes.
It's driving, and like the fog comes around his car. And
he ends up on Earth 1.
Yes. So that is hilarious, because I just read that on an hour ago. But that would be Earth Prime.
That's correct.
Our Earth.
That's correct. Very good. That was a good week.
All right. Moving on to Volume 76, Issue 8. This is the Daily Planet for the week of June 21st, 1976. Superman saves the Declaration of Independence. Dateline, Philadelphia, 1776. There's a plot afoot by the British Loyalists to steal the Declaration of Independence just before it is signed on July 4th, 1776. And there's only one man who can stop it. Is it Thomas Jefferson? John Hancock? George Washington? No, this is a job for Tomahawk. No, this is a job for Clark Kent, reporter for Benjamin Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette. What's this, you ask? Clark Superman Kent lives in 1976 and is a TV reporter for WGBS, right? Not according to Carrie Bates, Kurt Swan, and Tex Blaisdell in the full-length story Die Now, Live Later in Action Comics number 463. We don't want to spoil any of the surprises in the story, but we just know you'll be awaiting the magazine's arrival at your newsstand the week of June 28th. So you can see for yourself as our mild-mannered Man of Steel mingles with our nation's founding fathers. It's a bicentennial treat you won't want to miss.
I read this story last year. This is great. It was actually a two or three parter in Action Comics. It was fantastic. Carb Bark. We talked about him last month a little bit. He's the villain in this. It's a hoot. This is a great Superman bicentennial celebration. Much better than his Treasury edition.
Well, that's the thing. So
this could have been the Treasury.
One thing I have to warn readers, reporters, editors, whatever you guys are. When we say this is a bicentennial issue, it doesn't have the bicentennial top that the DC Comics had. Yeah, so it's a fantastic story. Clark Kent is really for real back in 1776, and he's in Colonial Williamsburg outfit costumes and all of that. This is a fantastic story, and kind of like what I was alluding to. The Superman salutes the bicentennial treasury, which is such like a bait and switch, like you could not believe. This story should have been expanded, and I guess maybe they probably weren't doing new treasuries at the time, right?
Well, on sale this week is the Legion of Superheroes one.
But I think that's still reprints, though, I think.
Oh, you're right. I thought that was the wedding issue. So yeah, they probably aren't doing new stories in the Treasury yet. Rob, let us know.
Well, and actually, no prizing it, I think what happened is so many people complained about being tomahawked that they said, well, we should have made the bicentennial issue of Superman a treasury, so we're going to start doing new treasuries.
There you
so
go.
I think that's probably
that must be the reason. That must be the reason.
But it is a great story. And the villain motivation is really good in that issue. Yeah, I like it a lot.
Yeah, me too. This is a great one.
Okay. Binky returns for summer fun. That popular teenage character Binky, who brought fun and laughs to thousands of fans over the years, will be returning to the DC lineup for a very special issue of All New Adventures during the week of June 28th. Old fans will welcome his return, and new readers will have the opportunity to meet him and all of his friends in Binky number 82. Watch for it. So, if you don't know who Binky is, it's Archie. It's DC's version of Archie. That's fine. I was a little bit disappointed with Binky. So my introduction to Binky was in the Best of DC Digest. And I'm not going to lie, like I had a subscription at the time and it would come in like that little brown envelope.
And you'd be all excited.
I would be super excited. And of course, back then, I didn't know what issue was coming out. So sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't. I definitely didn't know that Binky was going to be in an issue. Even that wasn't too bad because like you open it up and Binky isn't drawn like in like the quote unquote Archie house style. They were drawn like regular kids. So I'm like, oh, this is kind of interesting. And then like as soon as you open it up, you're like, oh, well, these are Archies. I think we talk about this, like our first love was superheroes. If you couldn't get superheroes, then maybe you'd go for Harvey or Archie or something like that. So I certainly read Archies, but back then I was kind of like, eh.
Yeah, I would never have bought a Binky comic book. So the only ones I do have are the ones that are in the DC specials for DC Giant and stuff like that. And those are not ones I bought when they came out. Those are ones that I bought to fill in the collection.
Yep, I understand that.
But what, Sean, what is the most interesting thing about this issue?
About the Binky issue?
Yeah, not the contents of the issue, but about the actual comic book.
Oh, I've never heard the story. I have no idea.
Okay, I stopped him.
I'm glad I'm listening to this podcast.
This is for June 1976. This comic book did not come out when they said it would. This comic, according to Mike's, didn't come out until the summer of 1977, a whole year later.
Oh, wow.
I don't know why, unless Mike's is wrong. So Binky 81 was the last issue, and that came out in 1971, according to Mike's. So they were bringing it back and having this just like a special issue. Why they didn't make it Binky Summer Fun and have it just be its own title, I don't know. You know, all those postal regulations and nonsense. So they brought out number 82. Again, unless Mike's is wrong, it did not come out till the summer of 1977. Anyway.
So when they did Watchmen, didn't Watchmen 1 through 11 come out monthly and then it was an entire year until Watchmen number 12? Isn't that right?
Well, it was not that long. It was more Camelot 3000 that was like a year almost between issues. Watchmen might have been delayed a little bit, but not nearly that much.
So it was Camelot 3000 that is doing the homage to Binky by bringing it out a year later.
That must be it. Yeah.
That's why they made that editorial decision.
I just happened to say, were there any other issues after this? Like, did it continue? And I clicked on Mike's, and no, there aren't any more issues after this. But then I was like, wait, it says 1977. We're in 1976. So.
That's funny.
Any Binky experts out there? If we're wrong, let me know.
The last story is Isis debuts in Shazam. Isis, that fabulous female who shares a Saturday morning television show with Captain Marvel, is now going to share a magazine with the Big Red Cheese as well. but only for one issue. In Shazam number 25, on sale the week of June 28th, you'll see The First Adventures of Isis in print, a collaborative effort of Denny O'Neill and Dick Giordano. Isis, as in crisis, will make this issue a collector's item. And if you're wondering why Isis will only be appearing in one issue of Shazam, it's because she'll be starring in her very own magazine beginning in July. So I have one issue of Isis, and of course I have this issue of Shazam, because I have all the Shazam from the 70s. I liked Isis. I loved Isis, watching Isis on TV. I loved it.
I know I watched it because I was watching Shazam and stuff. I have absolutely no recollection of Isis, like the storylines or any. I might have had an issue of this at one point, but I don't have much to say about Isis. Sorry. I know you like her.
I do, yeah. Great costume. I mean, simple costume, but great costume. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to go through the direct currents. On sale the week of June 28th. Man, let me tell you, the first two are worth it. Limited collector's edition number C48, the Superman Flash Race. A pair of super speed races starring a pair of super speedsters. Superman's race with the Flash is by Jim Shooter, Kurt Swan, and George Klein. Race to the End of the Universe is by E. Nelson Bridwell, Ross Andrew, and Mike Esposito. So I didn't have this like when it came out, but I definitely had it. I was a kid. I was still a kid, and I don't know, like in sixth grade somehow. I guess somebody had an old copy somewhere and either gave it to me or I traded or something. Because I do remember like being like so unknowing about comics. I don't even think I realized that they were just old issues reprinted. But I love both of those. Yeah,
I'm pretty sure I had it when it came out. This is a great one. And there's been a recent facsimile of it, if anybody wants to pick that up.
The next one is limited collector's edition number C49, Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes. The greatest superheroes of the 30th century face Mordru the Merciless and the Devil's Jury in the supersized edition, plus lots of fabulous features. Honestly, like, I didn't look it up, but isn't this the one that has that great Legion cover where, like, they're all flying? It's like Superboy's up right in the middle, and they're all radiating out. Because there were only two Legion treasuries, right?
Well, one's the wedding.
Yeah, and then this one, right? I think.
Let me check.
I have all the treasuries. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, this is the one where this is Mike Grell, where they're all coming out, which is a tremendous cover. Great one.
Detective Comics number 463. Batman's out to smash a drug ring, but so is the Black Spider, who traps the Caped Crusader in a death web by Jerry Conway, Ernie Chua, and Frank McLaughlin. And interestingly enough, then the Atom squares off against a new foe, the Calculator, in Crimes by Calculation.
Woohoo!
By Bob Razakis, Mike Grell, and Terry Elston.
I think we don't have to say any more about that.
Plop number 23, Our Army at War number 297, which is a story called Percentages. Commandy number 46, and that is The Wrath and the Fury, plus another Tale of the Great Disaster finale. House of Secrets number 142 with the stories Who Goes There, Food for Thought, and Playmate. So we are going to move over to the trivia quiz number 8.
All right, I'm ready.
Super speed is the big thing this week as our limited collector's edition spotlights the race between Superman and the Flash. But while these two speedsters are racing to the ends of the universe, can you name three other DC characters who are noted for their swiftness and also give their secret identities? Man, they're tough because that's like all you get. Can you name three other DC characters who are noted for their swiftness and also give their secret identities? So we talked about one. So.
Well, this is 1976, right? So we don't have Impulse or anybody like that, guys. But we've got obviously Kid Flash, Wally West, and obviously Jay Garrick.
Yes.
Flash.
Yes.
And then I was thinking, I said the only other one must have been Johnny Quick, whose, I think, secret identity was Johnny Chambers?
Yes. Good job.
I remember that from All-Star Squadron. Is that correct? Yes.
That is correct. Yep.
Yes. Very good. You know, there's also the Johnny Quick from Earth 3, and I don't know his secret identity. So the villain.
Yeah.
I think Bob missed a beat here. That's a little more of a stretch for the kids to have figured out.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was in another comic.
It does say characters.
Right. It doesn't say heroes. You know, there's also the Reverse Flash, right?
Right. And those answers aren't listed. And then also would, and he's only in my mind because we're going to talk about him, but like Mercury, would he have been in old issues of Wonder Woman, maybe? I guess, would that count?
I'm sure he was in some Golden Age issues, you know, with all the craziness in the Golden Age issues. I don't recall him being in the Bronze Age issues. Of course, once Perez and post-crisis, then all the gods were bigger roles. It's possible, but I don't recall. All right, another good week. Now we're going to move on to the last week of the month, the week of June 28th, 1976. And the big story is that superheroes battle to save three Earths. And this is, of course, the Earth 1, Earth 2, and Earth S crossover from the Justice League of America. Yeah, the location is Earth 1, Earth 2, and Earth S. King Kull, the Beast Man who has battled Captain Marvel numerous times, has come upon the ultimate scheme to thwart his foe. But Kull does not restrict his attack to his own world. Instead, he includes Earths 2 and 1 in the plan. By freezing the Shazam gods motionless in their headquarters, Kull makes it impossible for them to send forth the magic lightning bolt that would transform Billy Batson, Mary Batson, and Freddie Freeman into the Marvel family. The only one to escape Kull's attack is Mercury, who is sent by wise old Shazam to gather the other superheroes to bother the Beast Man. So then they talk about all the 18 heroes that are from the JLA and the JSA. Can they stop it? It's called Crisis in Eternity by E. Nelson Bridwell, Marty Pascoe, Dick Dillon, and Frank Laughlin in Justice League 135 on sale July 5th, the following week. Great crossover. Again, another one just covered recently on the Earth 2 podcast. I loved these crossovers. I mean, Earth 1, Earth 2 crossovers, fantastic always. But when they started throwing in a third team, man, I loved it. Because it's like, man, you're getting a lot of superheroes for your buck.
Okay, Planeteers. Each of you are special to me. Each of us have a bond that can never be broken by time or space. I unequivocally love the JLA JSA team ups. I absolutely think they are fantastic. I love Captain Marvel. I love the Marvel family. I have all the issues of Shazam, like the power of Shazam afterwards, all of that. Let me tell you, reading this was like an issue of DC Challenge. And although I love that, it's not like a great story. Two, like when they're trying to kind of like that fake group that they are, like, were they ever really like
No, they were
that?
never a group. That
See,
was a fake group.
that sticks in my craw. And the other thing, too, is even now, like Spy Smasher and Bullet Man and Bullet Girl, like, come on.
That was like the first time and one of the rare times I ever saw those. I think the Bullet Man and Bullet Girl appeared in the Shazam series in World's Finest, right? Didn't they come a couple of issues of that? But John Newton, the characters are pretty, other than the Marvel family, the characters are pretty weak. I agree.
And in
I mean, if there's
terms,
any Pinky or Spy Smasher fans who want to disagree with us, please let us know
yeah,
in the
please. I'm not yucking anyone's yum.
But this was much more exciting at 10 years old than it is today at 60 years old.
And it's funny because when I first started thinking about doing the planet, obviously I knew I was going to read the stories I'd have to talk about. And I thought, well, I should read all of the stories that are the headlines of this issue. And then I also thought, well, you know, when it's going to be a JLA, JSA, I'm going to read all three issues so that I get like the whole. Well, no, I didn't. I barely made it through this. And too, in terms of like Captain Marvel villain, King Kull is not my
No.
favorite.
I think I read something. He appeared like two or three times in the Golden Age.
Yeah. Planeteers, if you love this, I would love to hear your rebuttal because a lot of times when people talk about stuff they love, it can swing me around. So please bring me over to your side.
The next issue, Jimmy Olsen scares Superman to death in Metropolis. Fear is bursting out all over, but it's only affecting the men of the city. Suddenly, the male population is plagued by cases of everything from acrophobia to zoophobia, and nobody knows the cause. Is it really Lucy Lane, as Superman surmises, or can something else be cause? Man of Steel will have a terrible time finding out because he has come down with anthrophobia, the fear of people, and is scared to death of everybody, including his pal, Jimmy Olsen. Will the red-headed reporter be able to help his super pal, or will he tell the world, "I scared Superman to death" by Kerry Bates and Kurt Schaffenberger in Superman Family number 179. So, Sean, I had this issue. I think we've said before, I gifted you a number of Superman Family issues because I was culling them out of my collection. But I read them all before I did that, you know, those couple years ago. I have absolutely no recollection of this story.
I'm somewhat similar. No, I know I read it. I didn't not like it because that I would remember that. Kurt Schaffenberg cover is fantastic. Superman's cowering in fear. I do think it's funny that they talk about anthrophobia because the character Anthro.
And then the last storyline was Starfire, not that one, battles Mygorgs at Lortnan Manor. So I'm not going to read all this. This was the short-lived series, which was actually a pretty fun series. David Michelinie, Mike Vosburgh, and Vince Coletta were on this one, Starfire number 2. There were, I think, 7 issues. I did have them at one time. They were fun. I'd love to see like a Bronze Age sci-fi DC Finest. You could put all these in there, kind of like they did with the Western one. And that would be fun to reread. I do know that it was hampered by, lots of creative changes. I think she had 3 costumes and 7 issues, that kind of thing.
And I'll give it for DC, man. They were trying.
They were trying. They were definitely trying. All right. Direct Currents on sale the week of July 5th. Batman number 280. And this one is by David Reed and Ernie Chua. Still going by that. The Only Crime in Town. Star Spangled War number 202. The Cure. The Metal Men number 48. Metal Men versus Eclipso. And who's Bruce Gordon? And why is he doing these terrible things to himself? Jerry Conway, Marty Pasco, Walt Simonson. So I really enjoyed the Metal Men when they were brought back, in the 70s, like they did with the Titans and the Challengers and stuff. And they had some good art because they had Walt Simonson on it and then they had Joe Staton on it. I don't remember anything of those stories and they're long gone. I do not have any collections of classic Metal Men stories. You could probably do all the Silver Age and all the Bronze Age issues of Metal Men plus their guest appearances in 2 DC Finest and call it a day, because I would love to. And I know I've not read a lot of the Silver Age ones. Did you buy or read the Metal Men at this time, Sean?
They were in a digest, so I had that.
Okay.
They were in Wednesday Comics, so I had that. Yeah, guest appearances, stuff like that, but I've never...
You were in the Brain and the Bold several times. Yeah.
I think with Metal Men, I do kind of think it probably would make for a great animated show.
Oh, yeah.
I also think with something like this, it really needs to be a creator that really cares and loves them and has a fantastic art style. Like, I just think you just have to for Metal Men.
Yeah, it's got to be the right approach. But I do like them. I always enjoy it when they show up. But, I mean, this was number 48. And it was, so in the 60s, it ran 40-some issues before they brought it back. So, I mean, it's not like it's an insubstantial run, right? Yeah. The next one up was Super DC Giant, number 27. Another one that's eligible. Strange Flying Saucers Adventures, which I can't wait till somebody picks this one. Because this will be a fun one to do. I think there was one other DC special that had flying saucers. I think there are 2 in total. So either one of those will be a lot of fun. And then Young Love, number 121, which they promise a new look for the magazine as we present Biker's Girl, the girl who wanted to say yes, and nobody wants me. All right, Sean, trivia time. Not all superheroes were born here on Earth. Many came from worlds all over the universe. Can you name the heroes who came from the following planets? Krypton, Thanagar, Mars, Bismol, Titan, which is a moon of Saturn. So let's go through. Obviously, Krypton.
Supergirl. God, I'm sorry. Krypto.
Krypto. All right, I'll accept it. Thanagar.
Hulk Girl or Hulk Woman.
Yep. Mars.
I guess Ms. Martian wasn't around here yet, so I'll have to go with Jean Jones.
Bismol.
Matter Eater Lad.
There you go. That's a good one. And Titan, a moon of Saturn, which gives it away.
Yeah, it certainly does. Gives it right away. Like, I know it like that. What I'm doing is just building tension for the Planeteers, because they're thinking, oh, I know what it is, but Sean's going to say it because he knows for sure. He is going to say it because he knows it for sure.
It's a moon of Saturn.
Oh, okay. I get Saturn Girl.
There you go.
Okay.
So, and in the Marvel Universe, of course, Thanos comes from Titan.
Right. Okay. Oh, man. I was just building tension.
Oh, yeah, sure you are.
Makes for great podcasting.
All right, so we are finished our 4 weeks. We're going to quick give our awards for the month. Are you ready for the award ceremony, Sean?
Yes, I am.
All right, the photo award. Which of these images would you say has the best art?
So I am going to not cheat, but I do have to say Batman Family number 7, because it's my first comic. Mm-hmm. I think technically it probably would be Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, because I am going to go with Batman. And I remember talking about the cover, how like Batgirl swinging in on the Huntress and the Huntress is
the circular Robin thing.
Right, yeah.
It's an excellent composition. I'll go off the board a little bit. I'm going to pick that Joker cover. It's got a great cover.
Yeah,
you got
the
Catwoman swinging her whip at the Joker. She's got tigers. It's hard for me to tell with a small font there.
I think they're tigers.
Yeah. I think it's an Irv Novik. I like them. All right. The best debut or number 1. So there weren't a lot this month.
They kind of talk about Isis getting her own book.
That's
so.
A debut. That counts. Her first appearance, right? You know,
probably. Yeah. Oh, that. Yeah. That's. Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah.
So I think that's the only one. It's the only one I really saw. And the best comic that you've read. That's an easy one for you to answer.
It is easy. So yes, it's Batman Family number 7. But that World's Finest story, I loved. I think that is great. Even the Superman Bicentennial one, I liked that a lot. Batman Family is number 1. But like those other two.
Yeah, that's the winner of our hearts. But I really enjoy the Superman Carbon Bark time travel story. Right. I think that's great. And then what of all these ones that you haven't read, which one would you like to read?
So I'm super going to go offbeat, and Plop number 3 is talked about. So I'm going to go Plop. I'm going to go Plop 23.
Yeah, I was going to go with Binky, but then I said, you know, it might not technically count because it didn't actually come out that month.
Right, yeah.
So if it did, if we're not allowed to have Binky, then I was going to go with Starfire because I want to read. I've probably read those 15. Like I said, I probably picked up all 7 of them real cheap at some point, read them, and then got rid of them. So I would love to reread those. So I'm going to go with Starfire.
Yeah, I think that's good. Yeah.
All right.
That's it for this segment. Next month, we will, of course, have your reporter feedback, so please leave us some at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
All right, thanks, Sean. Now we have our next episode announcement. To coin a phrase, in July, DC Special Cast salutes the sesquicentennial. What better way to commemorate that than to celebrate the original 1940s super team, the Justice Society of America? My guest will be the irredeemable Shag. Sorry, I couldn't get anybody else. And we will cover DC Special number 29, The Untold Origin of the JSA. And of course, Sean and I will be moving on to July of 1976 with the Monthly Planet. So look for it on Sunday, July 5th. Now let's get to your comments about our May episode with my guest David Steele as we discuss DC Special number 25, The Three Musketeers and Robin Hood. Edo Bosnar is first up. He said, enjoyed the show. It's always a treat when David guest stars. Most of my comments, though, pertain to the Monthly Planet feature. First, I have to say that as someone who once owned the entire whopping 5-issue original run of Ragman, I really liked that series, and specifically that version of Ragman, the street-level hero with a rather morbid origin who didn't have any mystical aspects. On DC's Tarzan series, Tarzan the Untamed was an adaptation of the novel of the same name, in which, yes, at the beginning, Tarzan believes that his beloved Jane had been killed by German soldiers and goes on a bit of a rampage while tracking them down in Africa. It's been like almost 40 years since I've read these books, so I don't recall many of the details, but Jane was, in fact, not killed. Well, thanks for clearing that up, Ito, so that's great. Otherwise, when you mentioned DC Superstars of Space, it triggered a rush of nostalgia, as DC Superstars of Space number 2 is one of the earlier comics I owned. That cover with Adam Strange and Hawkman flying in outer space is burned into my brain. I'm looking forward to the next show. Thanks, Ito. You will be happy sometime in the next few months. That's all I'm going to say. Next up, Rob McCarthy asks, was the Viking Prince fairly serialized? After all, if you lose your memory, you got to find it. I wouldn't call it serialized, Rob. There was a theme to it, but it wasn't really serialized. Back to Rob. Shocking, no one. I will defend Brave and the Bold number 130 as having 4 famous co-stars. Between my beloved Joker solo series and the truly weird team-ups with the heroes, they were clearly trying to make something of the Joker. I mean, he showed up in DC Presents twice. Yeah, no question, Rob. We had some more Joker talk on this episode in the Monthly Planet, so let us know your thoughts. Past guest, movie Matt Saroy, said, what does any of this have to do with whipped chocolate covered in milk chocolate? Sorry? Obvious joke. Almost everything I knew about the Three Musketeers came from the Hanna-Barbera cartoon that aired during the Banana Splits show. It used to drive me nuts that it was titled The Three Musketeers, yet it featured 4 heroes. It was decades before I found out that D'Artagnan wasn't an actual musketeer during the novel, and I finally found peace with the concept. What does any of this have to do with the wonderful episode of DC Specials? Nothing really, I just thought I'd share. I'll see myself out. Okay, thanks, Matt. A Fire and Water All-Star. And don't tell Shag, but the real poobah of the Fire and Water Network, Rob Kelly, says, great show. Loved hearing from David. When I was on your previous show, Batman Family Reunion, I told a story about having Jose Delbo as an instructor when I was at Joe Kubert School and was not complimentary to him. I didn't know Rob went there. That's pretty cool. Anyway, to be fair to him, he gave us another assignment that was similar to the one I previously mentioned, where we had to create spot illustrations for a book of our choice. For this assignment, I picked The Three Musketeers because it was superhero-ish. For whatever reason, I tried a more humorous, cartoony style, and I remember it came out pretty well, and I got a good grade from Jose. I can't remember now why I didn't try that style again, since it went so well the first time. Okay, Now to put my film historian hat on. Upon your mention, I watched Buy Me This Town, the one movie written by Murray Boltanoff. It's not even 70 minutes, and it was on YouTube for free. And it was surprisingly pretty good. For a cheap B programmer meant to run at the bottom half of a double bill, it was fairly clever, had some fun twists, and I actually chuckled out loud a few times. Since Murray is only credited with the story, not the screenplay, I don't know that he deserves much credit for the dialogue, but the story is certainly unique. At one point, the lead character, the mobster who buys a small town, tells his skeptical new constituents about how he'll run things. He promises under his leadership, quote, no one will be homeless, quote, making him better than a lot of politicians running things right now. I was genuinely surprised at a line like that in this cheap little movie. So thanks for inspiring me to watch it. It was quite fun. Wow, that's really cool. Thanks, Rob. It's really neat that you were able to find that movie so easily, and even better that you enjoyed it. So I was really happy to hear that. Next up, Alan W. Wright chimes in. He says, excellent show, Paul and David. Back in the late 90s, I started researching the 1950s comics. This special run and The Best of the Brave and the Bold were economical ways to plug some gaps in my collection. I'll note the reprints were often recolored, and in the original Forest of Traps, Robin has a purple tunic on. I'd say the primary color of Robin's outfit in the 1950s was usually orange or red with green on the sleeves and leggings and so forth. Some scholars have said that Robin Hood's original color was red, and one of the medieval ballads he offers a guest cloth of, quote, scarlet and green, which Professor Thomas Olgren feels is probably a corruption of scarlet and grain. Wow. Robin Hood appeared in a variety of comics in the 1950s, thanks to the popularity of The Adventures of Robin Hood, which aired on the newly independent TV channels in the UK, ITV, and CBS in America. It was written by blacklisted Hollywood writers working under pseudonyms. Quality Comics began a series called Robin Hood Tales, which DC started publishing at the same time they took over Blackhawk. More on that here, and he gives us a link about Robin Hood comics. And yes, Dell did adapt the 1952 movie The Story of Robin Hood and His Merry Men in 4-color and would reprint the adaptation a few times. Dell also released a sort of classic illustrated style Robin Hood one-shot. Magazine Enterprises and Charlton also had Robin Hood comics in the 1950s. You notice that Robin didn't do much robbing in these stories, and that's probably what piqued my scholarly interest. How do you do Robin Hood when the first provision of the Comics Code says that crime and criminals should not be glamorized? That's exactly what we were wondering about, Alan. So yeah, good point. Murray Boltanoff's text piece is actually pretty accurate. The Nottinghamshire claims to graves and weddings, etc., is centuries of tourism, but the details are pretty correct. Aside from saying that Nottingham Castle, which, aside from the 13th century gatehouse, looks nothing like a castle anymore, and more like something that could serve as Wayne Manor, was built in 1608, more like 1068. Wow. He goes on, the art, especially by Russ Heath, is wonderful, as is the art on the Three Musketeers and the Viking Prince. Like you said, I really hope DC does a DC Finest : adventure collection with all the pre-superhero Brave and the Bold comics. I'll leave you with a tease. Did you know the major connections between the Three Musketeers and Robin Hood? Wow, that was great stuff, Alan. Thank you for all that awesome information. I love this stuff. Unfortunately, I don't know that connection, so let us know. But that was great. Thank you. Next up, Fire and Water All-Star, co-host of Mr. and Mrs. Superman, and past guest, Chris Franklin, chimed in. He said, fun show, Paul, David, and Sean. I've never read any of the DC Three Musketeers stories, but this sounds and looks interesting, despite D'Artagnan being a bit of a cad. I read that DC Digest that reprinted the early adventure strips from Brave and the Bold, and I've always up for more Robin Hood. And I would love to hear a Viking Prince podcast hosted by Paul. Well, not sure about a whole podcast, Chris, but I'm definitely trying to figure out how I can cover some of them. Oh, and not sure if you're aware, but there's a new film, The Death of Robin Hood, coming this summer with Hugh Jackman in the title role. I had not known that, actually, Chris, so thanks for letting me know. The Monthly Planet was worth the wait. Love the format and the insights from both my Bat cousins. I look forward to reading the Daily Planet, or before I could read, at least looking at the pretty pictures, and was very sad when they disappeared along with DC's Dollar Comics. Thanks, Chris. Super Captain's next. He said, my knowledge of the Three Musketeers comes mostly from the Hanna-Barbera cartoon that Matt Sirois mentioned above. And Robin Hood always brings to mind when he and Little John were walking through the forest. Ooh, da-lolly, ooh, da-lolly. Golly, what a day. I have seen the Kevin Costner movie, too. But the big and pleasant surprise here was David Steele's in-stock trades recommendation of William of Newbury. I love that little series and have begun to think that maybe I was alone in that. I also love the Daily Planet feature. You and Sean are always a dynamic podcasting duo. Thanks for another great episode, Paul. Well, thank you, Super Captain.
And next up, Bucky749 says, all for one and one for all. I'm a huge fan of these characters, and the Musketeers are some of my favorites. I didn't know D'Artagnan was based on a real person, though. Yeah, I know, Bucky. That was cool. So I'm glad you enjoyed that, too. He says, also, did you know that in the DC Comics, Green Arrow met Robin Hood? And I think it was in More Fun Comics. And in that version, it was revealed that Robin had more in common with our favorite Emerald Archer than we thought. I wish I could remember the issue number. Sounds like a fun story, Bucky. So hopefully, maybe one of our listeners knows. So here's a secret question. If DC did a Treasury of DC hero meets literary hero, team ups Brave and the Bold style, who would be in this book? For me, it would be on the cover would be Green Arrow and Robin Hood fighting off bad guys. And inside, we'd have the Green Arrow and Robin Hood team up, the Atom time travel adventure with Ben Franklin, time travel crossword with Kronos, the Sheriff of Nottingham's wanted poster, but a color by numbers, which would be pretty cool, a text on the greatest inventions and biggest myths of Ben Franklin, and Silent Night and a Shining Night stories, and then a separate cutout diorama containing all the historical characters and animals so kids can make their own stories where Ben Franklin and the Silent Night save the day. Wow, that sounds cool, Bucky. Thanks for sharing. Next up, Matthew Davis said, another fun episode as always. Several months ago, I had spare time to check out a store here in Richmond called Cerebral Vortex that sells used vinyl records and some older comics. They actually have a pretty nice selection, mostly vine or lower, and several boxes of $1 and $3 comics. I did find a few DC specials, including one of the other issues with the Three Musketeers and Robin Hood. So let me know if you want to do that one, Matthew. I'm happy to slot it in, you know, next year sometime or something. The 1970s Three Musketeer movie and its sequel came out in the mid-70s, but also Disney's animated Robin Hood movie. There was also a Robin Hood movie with Sean Connery as well. And yes, I say, add Super Team Family to the rotation. Wasn't it close to the same format? The Daily Planet feature started around the time I was really getting into DCs and was extremely helpful in letting me know what was coming out. Considering I had to change schools twice that year, any help was very much needed. Thanks, Matthew. Again, we'll see about Super Team Family. I'll be soliciting input this fall regarding content and format of the show, but I'm glad you liked the episode. Past guest, friend of the network, Martin Gray says, what a treat to have the other half of the fabulous Earth 2 podcast, David, follow his podcasting partner, Peter, onto the show. As regards to the Warriors 3 collection you recommended, Paul, does it not contain that excellent story from Marvel Spotlight number 30 by Len Wein, John Buscema, and Joe Sinnott? It's massive fun and is their first spotlight away from Thor, I believe, a nutty omission. I don't actually have that book, Martin, so I'm not sure. I was just reading the solicit from In Stock Trades, but I recall the story you mentioned, I think maybe from a Thor Epic Collection, I think I have. I'm not sure where I read it, but great stuff. Back to Martin. I've never seen a Three Musketeers film or TV show or read the book. The most I know is Aramis was a men's scent, but this comic looks all kinds of fun. I am a fan of John Collins, so it was great to have his work once again part of the show, and I had no idea Murray Boltonoff also had story credits. I really enjoyed the profile of Mr. Boltonoff. These bios are a favorite part of the show. Thank you, Martin. I love, 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 love the Monthly Planet section. How soon can we spin this off to its own show? And yes, Hercules Unbound was indeed in Showcase Presents The Great Disaster. Paul, are you having a selective memory moment, denying that in between Irv Novik and Return of Carmine Infantino in The Flash, there was Don Heck? I had forgotten, Martin. Thanks for reminding me. I may have blocked it out, but I should have remembered since I did read them earlier this year. I also love the 70s Flash. Have you penciled in the DC Special Series number 11, The Flash Spectacular? Surely someone has snapped that up. Not yet, Martin. I hope it'll be next year. And since you asked, please don't add Super Team Family to the show's remit. Save it for its own series once you're done with Superman Family. Super Team Family has some good stuff in it, but by gum, it was the stupidest title. And never mind a florist and a fashion designer, you forgot that Dinah Lance was once Bruce Wayne's secretary for one issue. Actually, maybe I imagined hearing that. No, that sounds like a Bob Haney thing, Martin. And don't discount Karate Kid solo book, Paul. It got really good when Bob Ruzakis took over and we had Diamond Death debut. Catch you later, you special man. Thanks as always, Martin. I appreciate all your thoughts. Next up, Robert J. Smith. Super Team Family gets my enthusiastic vote, which you could probably have guessed from my comments in the previous episode. I might as well make it official. And the Super Team Family debate roils on. Next up, Fire and Water All-Star, host of Cheers Cast, and past guest Ryan Daly says, wonderful episode, as always. I hadn't read any of the DC's Three Musketeers or Robin Hood stories, but I've been a fan of these characters for as long as I can remember, so it's a treat to hear you and David discuss those further adventures of the famous swashbucklers. That said, the Monthly Planet segment was outstanding. It feels like I've been waiting a year to hear you and Sean do this, and it was such a pleasure to listen to. The only thing I can ask is don't make this a backup feature in the regular DC special cast. It's like making Green Lantern a backup in Superman. They deserve their own title. Monthly Planet could and should be its own show. or at least separate episodes from the regular DC Special Cast episodes. Otherwise, it could overshadow whatever your, quote, lead comic is and that particular guest. Well, thanks, Ryan. And again, over the fall, we'll make some decisions. For the next few months, at least, we'll definitely stick with Monthly Planet as a segment, but, you know, stay tuned. Network Bro, Brett Young says, great show, Paul and David. I've never seen or read this special before, but it's always fun to see classic characters. D'Artagnan does give off real creep vibes. The other three should ditch him, since there's only supposed to be three anyway. When David was mentioning cinematic versions of Robin Hood, it immediately sent me back to my youth, when the Prince of Thieves movie with Kevin Costner came out. It lives rent-free in my head, mostly because I saw this movie in the theater with a cute redhead. The summer of 91 rocked. Finally, good on Paul for getting to cover his favorite Viking prince. The dude can handle the cold. I'm with Ryan. I feel like Monthly Planet with Sean is taking on its own life. This needs to be a spinoff and grow the DC Special Cast franchise like the Arrowverse. You should definitely add Super Team Family to the list. I think one has a backup Green Arrow story drawn by Jack Kirby. Also, I'm always here for a Superstars of Space special if you need someone. Space Cabby is just out there doing his best so Space Uber doesn't take all his fares. And the debate continues to rage. Thanks, Brett. And finally, Lizanne Oswalt pipes in and says, awesome podcast. I've always loved the Three Musketeers and Robin Hood. These are not the best representations of the characters, especially with D'Artagnan acting like such a jerk. But it was awesome to hear these stories, though I've never read the comics. I can't wait until the next podcast. Well, thank you, Lizanne. And that's it for the comments. Thank you to everyone who wrote in. It means a lot to me, as I've said, and I enjoy reading everybody's comments and responding to them. As always, please leave your comments on the show post of our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And a reminder that if you like what you hear on this show or any of our network shows, please consider becoming a patron to help defray the costs. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice or suggest an episode to the network. Special thanks go out to our Sunday supporters, Al the Comics Guy, David Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, Mike Atchison. And to find out more, go to patreon.com/FWPodcasts. And thanks. That'll do it for the feedback section and for this episode. Special thanks, of course, to Dr. Ange for being on the show. He is just the best. I hope everybody enjoys the Supergirl movie. Thanks for listening, and I hope you will join me next month as the irredeemable Shag and I discuss the untold origin of the Justice Society of America.